Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. I know you will. Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Burchy. Justin's here.
Hey everyone.
And we got a big show this week. We got a special, very special guest. We've been trying to get him on the show for years at this point, and it's finally happening. So joining us this week, it's the former director of marketing from the former company, Bandai Entertainment USA. And currently he's a freelance writer working on comics and stuff right now.
Yeah, mostly working on comics, and I'm doing a consulting job for a company in Warner Brothers. But I guess I'll talk about that later.
Cool. Well, anyway, it's Robert Napton. Do you prefer Robert or Bob?
You know, it's funny. In the old days, I went by Bob, and then I kind of switched. So I answer to both because people refer to me as both. But Bob is fine. I think more anime people call me Bob.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being on the show, Bob. We really cannot thank you enough.
Oh, no, it's good to finally be here. I feel it's like kind of my final rite of passage as a member of the anime industry. If I didn't do this show, it wouldn't be complete. So it's fun to be to finally be here. We actually used to listen on Fridays in the office. We'd crank you guys up and everyone would kind of listen in. So I'm happy to finally be here.
Wow, okay. Well, it's great to have you. So a couple of weeks ago, we had a former colleague of yours, David Riddick, on. He was talking about the old days in the 80s with U.S. renditions, which you were a big part of. So I guess let's start from the top. Like, I guess, did you start as a fan?
Yeah, in brief, definitely started as a fan. I mean, yeah, as a kid, I saw Kimba and Speed Racer, and I was attracted to them without really knowing why, like most of the people from my generation. But the gateway show for me was a show called Star Blazers, which, of course, everyone knows is Space Cruiser Yamato, or as it's better known right now, Yamato 2199. Mm-hmm. But that series really opened the door for me because it was broadcast. I saw it on a station called Channel 2 out of Oakland, and it was kind of a funny thing in those days. I caught the tail end of this, but they used to have hosts for kids shows. This is something your younger viewers or listeners, I should say, are going to be like, what's he talking about? But they would have people come on and kind of introduce the show. And the person that broadcast Star Blazers was actually a kind of a legendary host in the Bay Area by the name of Bob Wilkins, who hosted a Saturday night horror show called Creature Features. And the reason I'm going into this, because it's kind of significant, he would have on local fans on his show. And one of those for Creature Features, whenever they would show the Godzilla movies, was a guy named August Rigoni. And August is pretty well known still in the Japanese live action fandom circles. In fact, he wrote a book about Godzilla that was published a couple years ago. So he's still very active on the scene. And anyway, when they had Bob Wilkins do this kids show, science fiction kids show, which was called Captain Cosmic, he brought August on during one of the Star Blazers broadcasts, and August explained to everyone, the show you're watching is actually a Japanese cartoon called Space Cruiser Yamato, and he brought in a bunch of merchandise that he had purchased in Japantown in San Francisco. And as a kid, it just kind of blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, this is something I just didn't expect to learn about this show. And that literally was the moment that I discovered there was such a thing as anime. And from there, I joined Michael Pinto, who's also still very active on the scene. He had a Star Blazers fan club. You sent him a dollar and you would get the newsletters. So I did that. And those newsletters were a huge gateway for me because it led me not only to the Cartoon Fantasy Organization and corresponding with Fred Patton when I was like 12 or 13, but it also led me to Books Nippon and Pony Toy Around in Little Tokyo. Even though I lived in Northern California, we would visit my grandparents every summer and every Christmas. So in 1981, I convinced my older brother to drive me to downtown LA. And I remember it very clearly. Sometime in the fall of 1981, I walked into the Books Nippon store as a teenage kid and found their anime section and this treasure trove of Yamato Roman albums and film comics and just started, you know, buying what I could and just realizing there was so much more to this whole world of anime than I had ever known. And of course realized shows like Speed Racer and Battle of the Planets were actually also anime. And that's really how it all started for me when I was a teenager.
Wow. Okay. And so that was the seed, and eventually you stayed in Los Angeles. Did you move to Los Angeles to become part of this? How did you get involved specifically with, U.S. renditions at that point?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. My family ended up moving to L.A. in 1984, and that was really a great time to move here for anime. The summer of 84, there was a big convention in L.A. called Worldcon. At the time when I went to it, it was the biggest convention I'd ever been to. There was probably about 15,000-20,000 people. It's pretty much a hard science fiction literary convention, but at that time the media had sort of overtaken it because Star Wars and Star Trek were so big. But it was really the first convention where I experienced anime, you know, on that level. They screened a 35mm print of Lensman, and that was the first time I'd seen anime on the big screen. And all the guys that I had sort of been having a correspondent relationship with and the CFO were running the video room. So I met Fred Patton and all those original CFO guys. And Carl Masick was actually there at that convention with Booby Trap, which was the pre-Robotech dub of Macross, and he premiered it in the video room to like 20 of us. And that really kind of being in that local community really got me going in fandom. And, you know, just to make a long story short, from there, I met David Riddick at a CFO meeting. And the great thing about Dave is he and I were pretty similar in age. You know, Fred and the other guys running the CFO, you know, they were great guys. But to me, at that time, they were older gentlemen. Now, I say that knowing they were probably the age I am now. But at the time, you know, I was in college and Dave walked in and here was this guy that was more of a peer. And he was running a club called CFO Gardena. So I started hanging out there. And then when Dave got hired at Books Nippon and founded U.S. Renditions with Kevin Seymour, about a year into that, Dave came to me and said, hey, you know, Kevin and I and the staff at Nippon are sort of needing some extra help, specifically on one project in particular, and I want to recommend you to Kevin. And so I went in and interviewed with Kevin, and I got hired. So I really owe all of that to my friendship and association with David.
Well, what was the project?
It was an Ixer One film comic. I'm assuming your audience knows what film comics are. They're kind of passe now, but they're like, they used to be books that would replicate the shows, you know, cell by cell, kind of like the American version was the photo novel, and they would have captions. And they wanted to do one for Ixer One in English, and they wanted someone, because Dave knew my interest was also in writing. I mean, we had talked, you know, he was a film student at Long Beach, and I was sort of a would-be writer, so he knew that was something that I would be really interested in. So I was brought in to rewrite the really rough translation of the Ixer One comic script. And so I spent a lot of time on it, and as would be kind of the epitome of my career in anime. Of course, it never came out. You know, there's all these projects that you work on that somehow end up getting buried, but for whatever reason, I can't recall at the time, but it got canceled. And, I then went on to help Dave on the Robotech CD. And then of course, you know, on a fateful day in 1989, Kenny Iodomi walked into, Books Nippon with the pitch of Gunbuster and Dan Gaio. And of course we all jumped on that and, the rest is history.
Are there any particular stories you remember from those heady days of? I don't want to get too deep into this ground that we covered with David, but I'm sure you have some stories that would stick out in your mind.
Well, one funny story, but I also think there's kind of a point behind it, is what I affectionately referred to as Star Blazers Mountain. There was a line of books that Books Nippon published. I think definitely before even Kevin Seymour was hired, which were English film comics of Star Blazers. I have no idea how that deal happened, but they somehow hooked up with Nippon, the publishers of Star Blazers, and decided to make these English graphic novels. So for volume one and two of that series, they had ordered about 30,000 of each. And I remember when Kevin got hired, he told me he cut the orders down on volumes 3, 4, and 5, which completed the series to about 5,000 units or 6,000 units, whatever, you know, he thought could realistically sell. So we had this secondary warehouse that was almost exclusively dedicated to these books. And it literally, I mean, picture the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, when they're putting the Ark away. A section of that is kind of what it looked like. And it was just all Star Blazers books. And so I used to kid around and call it Star Blazers Mountain because I would go to the warehouse and climb to the top of it. And it was about 30 feet off the ground. And I'd just be standing there like, wow, they really overestimated this. And the reason I think it's a kind of important point to make is there, I think there's two kinds of attitudes in Japan about anime that companies have toward the North American market. And that is either, you know, kind of a slight indifference or, just we don't care about the North American market. That's one attitude. And the other attitude is this just what I like to call this magical thinking. It's just this crazy overestimation of what a title, because it's successful in Japan, can do in the United States. And to me, the Star Blazers Mountain story kind of symbolizes that whole overreach and just disconnect that can occur between Japanese animation companies and rights holders and the American market. And unfortunately, that's a trend that I think has never gone away.
I was going to say, I see no symbolism between that and what happens later in the story at all.
Star Blazers Mountain. I wish I had a picture of it. In fact, I think Kevin did finally take a picture of me climbing on top of it, but I don't know where it is. And I'm sure all those books ended up just getting destroyed at some point.
That's a shame. I half expected they ended up at like Big Lots or something.
I mean, hopefully they ended up somewhere, but just knowing the way things were done, I'm sure at some point someone just said, okay, just shred them, you know?
So there were, I remember actually before we leave the U.S. renditions era, there was a particular story that you told me once about what the recording sessions were like for Orgus. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because that was one area that I don't think David really had that much participation in.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple things I want to tell about LA Hero. So about, sure. About five, let's see, I want to say about 4 years into my time at Nippon, you know, Ken Iodomi had come and we had done the deal together on Gunbuster, and then that led, as Dave described, to the other ones. And then there came a point where Ken kind of approached the Nippon management and said, you know, I'd really like to hire Robert, but because I was working for Books Nippon, and, you know, it's not a good thing to kind of, you know, hijack employees with companies you're working with, he actually went to the management and said, is it okay if I hire him part-time? And they said yes. So I started working part-time at Books Nippon and part-time at LA Hero, who were located at the opposite ends of LA, and I lived in the middle. So I spent most of my time in the car, which would also be a theme that would kind of run throughout my anime career. And at LA Hero, we decided to start dubbing. Basically, that was around 1992, and the first projects we were going to dub were Orgus, Guyver, and Macross 2. And at the time, we wanted to work with a studio called Magnitude 8, a recording studio. And this had been a studio that Ken had discovered because of a film called Kung Fu Rascals, which was directed by Steve Wang. Steve Wang is an effects guy who worked with Stan Winston on The Predator, helping design the Predator costume. He went on to make his own movie. And Les Claypool, who ran Magnitude 8, was helping Steve do all the audio for this film. So we really wanted to work with Les to record, but he was really busy with Kung Fu Rascals. So we had to find another recording studio, and of course budget was low. So the place we ended up finding, and people really don't believe this story when I tell them, but it was a recording studio on Ventura Boulevard in the Valley. And the recording booth was literally built in. It was one of those houses on the hill. Mm-hmm. And the recording booth was literally built into the hillside. And what was strange about it, imagine a room with four walls and two of the walls were just dirt. And I mean, literally just like dirt, rubble from a mountain. And there is a room sort of attached to it. And there were two microphones and this old TV. And that's where we ended up recording the first two episodes of Guyver and Orgus. And the funny thing is the control booth, and Justin, you'll appreciate all this just on the technical level, because it was beyond primitive. I mean, it was like, imagine an episode of Gilligan's Island. You know how they had like all the professor would make the phone out of a coconut? That's kind of what it was like.
Oh,
you know,
God.
Like the microphones were coconuts, and you know, the recording booth was upstairs, and there was no microphone between the booth and the control room. So my job was to sit in the middle of the second floor near the staircase to the upstairs, so I could hear the ADR director, who I think was Kevin Seymour, shouting directions to me, which I would relay to someone who was sitting next to the control booth, who would tell the actors. That was the intercom. Three
oh,
people.
God.
I'm not making this up. I wish I were.
That explains a lot.
It was hilarious. And of course, if you listen to those shows, they sound like this because they were recorded basically inside a cave. You know, it was like we were inside a mountain cave. Have no idea what happened to the studio. And they were really nice guys. So,
it's Hollywood. I'm sure it's been, you know, someone's drug den, you know, maybe a bondage room at some point.
It was totally bohemian, you know, Tarzan lifestyle going on there. And the funny story about all this is, you know, at that time I was in college. I was working for Ken and Nippon, and I was living with roommates, and I came home after one session, and you know, I took a shower, and you know, when you're all a bunch of guys in college, you live together, you know, no one's very, very tidy. And yeah. I remember my roommate complaining. He's like, "Dude, where were you? Were you hiking today, man? There's like mud in the shower." And I was like, "No, I was in a recording studio." And
wow.
He was like, "What do you mean?" And I was like, "It's a long story, forget it." But literally, I came away with so much dirt and grime at the end of each day that it would kind of leave that sort of impression. So it was funny. And so we realized, of course, quickly the error of our ways. And fortunately, Les finished Kung Fu Rascals before we started the Volume 2s. So all the Volume 2s were and from then on were recorded at Magnitude 8. And I just remember we'd go, "Les, the studio is so great. You know, it's so clean." And he was like, "What do you mean it's so clean?" You know, it's like, "You don't know where we've come from, you know." But it was humble beginnings.
Jeez.
And recording at Magnitude was great. And I do want to mention one guy from that era who, you know, I'm proud to say I was there when he started his career. And that was Steve Bloom. I mean, I was there the first day he recorded ADR on a show. And, you know, he's been a lifelong friend. And I remember one episode of Orgus, you know, he was playing two roles. And we had a couple of actors that were coming in to play smaller roles like guards, and the actors just flaked on us. You know, back then it was a totally different thing, and they just didn't show up. So Steve was there, and we're like, "Steve, you know, we got to finish this. Can we just keep you all day? And can you just try to come up with like different voices?" And he literally did in one episode. There's one episode of Orgus where Steve Bloom did like six voices, seriously. And he just could do it. And you right then and there, I was like, "Wow, this guy is like, he's got it," you know, the kind of it factor. And the fact that he's gone on to such acclaim and is now the voice of Wolverine and all that doesn't surprise me at all. And I couldn't be happier for his success. And Melissa Fawn, the same way. She was started with us and, of course, went on to do Cowboy Bebop and then Wicked on Broadway. And there were a lot of talented voice actors who got their start in some very humble beginnings, courtesy of U.S. Renditions and L.A. Hero.
Wow. Well, that's good stuff. So the one other thing that that David wasn't able to tell us a whole lot about was the dissolution of LA Hero, because he was more on the U.S. rendition side of things. Can you tell us a little bit about how all that stuff ended up transferring to manga entertainment?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Dave left Nippon, and then I actually ended up leaving Nippon and LA Hero around the same time in 1993. As I mentioned, I'd kind of harbored notions of being a creative entity, the entire time I was working in anime. So in 1993, there was a guy named Carl Altstetter, who David and I had known since our anime club days, who was very much part of the anime scene. And he and I had co-created a comic called Q Unit, which we sold to a publisher. And I had the tough decision of kind of pursuing the creative life or staying with anime. And leaving Nippon was actually an easy decision for me, but leaving LA Hero was a kind of a tougher decision, because it was still fairly new and there was a lot that needed to be done. And I was grateful to Ken for having brought me on board. But just the opportunity to write comics was something I couldn't really pass up. So I actually wasn't there when they ended up selling to manga. But my understanding was, from what I heard, it just made business sense. I mean, LA Hero was a division of a company called Hero Communications in Japan, and that's where the Hero Communications came from, and where the LA Hero came from. And I think there was an opportunity for Ken to join forces with manga because they were a much stronger entity. And it just made business sense. So when manga basically absorbed LA Hero, they acquired all those titles that we had done. It was as simple as that. And I know like George Lambros, a guy who I'd worked with at Books Nippon, who went to LA Hero after I left, he ended up moving to Chicago and working at manga for their, time that they had those titles.
I see. So you were off doing comics. Could you just tell us a little bit about that time in between and how you ended up at Bandai?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, my partner Carl and I launched this book called Q Unit, which actually was pretty successful in 1993. And in the 90s for comics, as some of your listeners I'm sure know, was really a boom time. A company called Image was formed by a bunch of artists, superstar artists who left Marvel very triumphantly and started their own company called Image. And after Q Unit, Carl and I ended up working for one of the partners of Image, a guy named Rob Liefeld. And we did that for a few years. And then we started our own company called Hyperworks and released a comic called Deity, which sort of became a cult hit. And I really immersed myself in that world. And, strangely enough, I seem to get to see a lot of rise and falls, but the comic industry, the sort of image revolution, the bubble burst in the mid-90s, and a lot of, there was like 8,000 comic book stores in 12,000 American cities in 1994. And by the end of the 90s, there was like 2,000 in the same amount of cities. So it really retracted, and comics began to struggle. And they're still, I mean, the comics industry, despite all the success with Hollywood, is still, as a print form, is still trying to recover from that in many ways. I'd been a freelance writer for 10 years. And interestingly, the manga boom happened toward the early 2000s. And I just got in contact. I mean, I'd been in contact with different people from my anime days over the years. And one day I got a call from Ken, just out of the blue, Kenny Adomi. And he said, look, I want Bandai to start a manga division. And because of your experience in anime and your experience in American comics, I think you'd be perfect to run it. Are you interested? And one of the things I'd never done in comics was really run a publishing division. I'd been a writer. I'd sort of, helped a bit with Hyperworks in terms of being a publisher, but I'd never really built up a division from scratch. So I said yes. And then 2004, I ended up coming back to Bandai, basically to focus on manga.
Well, before we go any further with that, I got to rewind a little bit. What was it like working with Rob Liefeld? And was there any indication then that he would become the figure he is now? Because I know he was huge in the mid-90s, but then people were like, hey, this art isn't very good.
You know, that was a fascinating thing to live through and to be a part of, because all those guys, Rob Liefeld, Todd McFarlane, Jim Lee, those three, Mark Silvestri, those four,
right.
Eric Larson, Jim Valentino, less or so, but those four were really like rock stars when they started Image. I mean, they were doing TV commercials and, you know, it was crazy. They were just printing money. I mean, they were selling like a million copies of some of those books. And, you know, it's funny you'd bring this up, because I think a lot of the guys at Extreme Studios where we were like, oh my God, this is great. This is never going to end. And maybe because I'd been in anime and I'd had a little more experience and I'd kind of seen things kind of rise and fall, uh-huh. I said, you know, I don't think this is going to last. This just can't be sustained forever. And so when the end came, I wasn't totally surprised. But yeah, Rob, God, that's a story for that could go on for days. I mean, Rob's a really charismatic guy, and he's great at telling stories, and but you know, he's definitely one of those guys that's polarizing, like you know, the late Carl Masick, who I had a good relationship with, but also bumped heads with at times. You know, when people have a strong opinion and they speak their mind, they tend to run afoul pretty fast, and so Rob definitely made some enemies in the comics community for some of the things he would do and say. But you know, working for him, I mean, I was professional and I just did my job. And probably the most fun I had with him is we relaunched Battlestar Galactica in 1995. We were both big Galactica fans of the original show as kids, and so he got the license, and everyone thought he was crazy, except for me. And I was like, I've got to write this comic with you. And so we did a huge relaunch of Battlestar that actually led to Universal licensing, realizing they had something that they shouldn't just be ignoring. So in a small way, we helped bring that show back. So that was a lot of fun. It was a fun time, but yeah, it was definitely drama, high drama.
Well, I don't want to harp on this too much, but I find it fascinating, and I know a lot of our listeners do too. What was there any indication then that he would be, because you know his name, it's very specific meaning in the comics community now, and was there any indication then that that's kind of who he would become? Because nowadays you mention his name, people are just like, hey, look at this Captain America, LOL, like, you know, that famous image of his that people kind of use to sort of beat him over the head with.
Oh, sure.
I mean, was there any indication that people would eventually just turn on him like that? I mean, he's such a...
Yeah. I mean, honestly, even then it was happening. I mean, really? You know, Rob did New Mutants and he did X-Factor, and it was at a time when you could kind of get away with that more, you know, abstract style.
Right.
You know, Jim Lee was kind of the master craftsman. I mean, you know, just technically impeccable in terms of the way he would draw the human figure in motion. And Mark was kind of in between Jim and Rob in that Mark could go very stylized. And it would, but it would still have that foundation of draftsmanship. And Rob wasn't like that. He just didn't draw that way. He drawed kind of from his gut, and it didn't have to make sense to anyone else. And like I say, I mean, he's a guy with a strong perspective on what his work should be. Mm-hmm. And that's how I liken him to someone like Carl Masick, who was very dogmatic in his opinions. And Rob was the same way from day one. So yeah, he clearly was already earning some of, his, detractors back when I was working for him, and he'd just be like, hey, people don't like my work, whatever, you know? And I think he still feels that way.
Yeah, well, that much is obvious, but,
Yeah. So, but it was interesting. It was interesting to kind of be around someone who was that confident that he just didn't want to bear any criticism, and he really didn't. It was a wild ride. I mean, you know, like I say, he was building spaceships that were at Comic-Con. I mean, you know, just to promote his comic and just costumes, you know, creating costume characters. And, you know, there's a huge studio. There was like 40 or 50 of us, you know, cartoonists and artists. And I was one of like three writers. So it was very interesting to see it all rise and fall.
Great. Now let's spend the next hour talking about Warriors of Plasm.
Exactly.
So that sort of gives us an insight into that period. I guess we're ready to start on Bandai. So tell us the beginning of that story.
Well, I was brought in to, as I say, to do manga. And, you know, it was interesting because Ken's philosophy for manga, you know, obviously Tokyo Pop was going through their incredible boom. And, you know, there were Viz, of course, was going through their boom, and they still are doing very well. But Ken's philosophy and his goal for manga was to create a very small, robust line that would really complement the anime. So what I'm getting at is, like, for example, we would release the the Eureka 7 anime, and we would want to release the Eureka 7 manga the same way we would want to release the Eureka 7 soundtrack. So that was kind of the philosophy. It wasn't like, let's do 60 titles a month and try to take over market share and da-da-da. So even with those modest goals, it was incredibly hard for me to ramp up Bandai Manga, because in Japan, unlike Viz, who kind of has Shueisha in their back pocket, you know, giving them titles, we didn't have that in Japan. Bandai Japan did not have a publisher equivalent. So I couldn't just call someone up and say, okay, I want these 10 titles to launch with. So I had to start from scratch and go to licensors and try to convince them that Bandai could be a book publisher, which a lot of them just didn't believe, because in Japan, Bandai is not known as for publishing. It's known for toys. It's known for entertainment, software, you know, games, you know, DVDs, Blu-rays, etc. But just, it's not known as a publisher. So a lot of the licensors were very unreceptive to our initial overtures to license titles. And it really took Eureka 7 was the gateway for us, because Kadokawa Shoten, who had the manga license, you know, took a chance with us, and we released that manga, and it was very successful for them and us, and they became a really important partner for us on publishing. But we really had to prove ourselves in it, and I had to build the whole thing from scratch. I had to get the printers lined up, I had to get the distribution lined up, and the whole buildup took almost 2 years. I mean, really, the whole of 2004 and 2005, I was just trying to build this thing internally. And I give Ken Iodomi a lot of credit for his patience, because it took a lot longer than mm-hmm. either of us thought it would. And he stuck with it. So I'm always appreciative of that, because we built the program into what we always intended it to be, which was a small but successful manga publishing program. You know, we had some good hits, like with Lucky Star, and I'm proud of what we were able to accomplish, really, from nothing.
Wow. Now, this whole time, were you working on nothing but comics, or were you split in other roles too?
So for the first 2 years, I was exclusively focused on manga. And then when Jerry Chu, who, of course, you guys also had on the show, left in 2005 or 6, I want to say, you know, I don't know if all Japanese companies are run this way, but ours in particular seemed that when someone left, it was kind of easier to give someone else their job than to find a replacement. And maybe it was because I had done it before. You know, I mean, at LA Hero Nippon, we all did everything. There was no specialization. You know, everyone had a hand in everything. And I think because Ken knew me from then, he knew I could handle marketing. So I was asked to sort of take over Jerry's responsibilities. And similarly, like George Lambros left and Sam Maseba became took over George's job of sales. And so that's just how it was. And that also coincided with Namco merging with Bandai in Japan. So we became Namco Bandai, and there was a bit of a reorg of the business units and kind of the priorities. So that's how I ended up sort of having the two hats to wear, at Bandai Entertainment, and that pretty much went on till the end.
Wow. So, okay, so you basically had this all sort of dumped into your lap. I hopefully assume that you had an increased profile, increased responsibility, hopefully an increased salary, and they weren't just making do with the skeleton team, which maybe they were.
No. Yeah, it was a promotion of a kind. So yeah, I definitely want to make that clear. I was given a promoted to director, which is one level below a VP, and you know, so yeah, it wasn't just like, oh, here, go do this. It was more of a question: would you be willing to do this? And you know, actually, when I was back in the old days, I enjoyed the panels and the conventions. At least I thought I did from my memory. Of course, when I started doing it again, I was like, oh my God.
That must have been a completely different crowd for you. Like, dealing with the anime fans must be totally different from dealing with the manga people.
Yeah, and dealing with the... Yeah, no, it was completely different. And just, you know, that kind of target on your chest. When you're the director of marketing, when you're in marketing for an anime company, I don't care if it's Bandai, Funimation, you know, Sentai, you name it, you know, you're just... You got a lot of people with pitchforks just ready to stab you when you get off the stage. So, and I'm being cynical when I say that. I mean, there's a lot of really nice people who are very enthusiastic, but the people with the pitchforks tend to stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's violent intent in some of the things they have to say. So that was a little, you know, but it wasn't that much different at Books Nippon. Books Nippon had plenty of detractors, and we would have to take it on the chin a bunch of times over things. So, but that actually is something that for me is a very tedious process. I mean, I can't speak for others. I think there are others who handle it much better than I do, or did, I should say, speak in the past tense. Like Lance at Funimation, who's a friend. I mean, I think he's great at all that and never, you know, always keeping a smile on his face. I get a little testy with some of that, and that's just how I felt about it. So, you know, there were times when I definitely was frustrated by the conversation we would have with some of our fans.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of these people have seemingly a superhuman ability to tolerate shit being flung directly at their head. Like, it's I never understood how they managed to keep their composure and not just be like, all right, fuck all of you guys.
Yeah, it's, you have to swallow a lot of stuff. And I would definitely have moments where I would want to. It's funny, David Riddick said something to me because he's known me for 25 years. When he saw the Avengers, he goes, you know that scene when Dr. Banner says, you know, my secret cap is I'm always angry. And then he turns around, becomes a Hulk. That kind of reminded me of you. And I was like, yeah, you know, that's pretty accurate. I mean, I really had to work hard to kind of keep my cool at times. I had to make an effort to do that. And like you say, some people are just so much more graceful with that. But I would just want to say, look, dude, you know, I'm sorry. Turn A Gundam's not here. You're not going to get it today. I know you want it. Duly noted. I'll let Sunrise know. What else do you want me to say? You know, and they would be like, no, but, you know. And again, I'm looking at the glass, you know, half empty. There were plenty of nice and positive moments. But the vocal minority is definitely vocal in anime.
So let's get into the nitty gritty here. So you basically took over for marketing in about 2005 after Jerry Chu left. What was the state of, because 2005 was a heady year for anime, you know, like that was right before it all just, you know, flushed down the toilet. What was the state of the business when you took over for marketing on anime?
You know, it's kind of funny. I think, if I have any regret about my quote unquote career in anime, it's that I was there at the beginning and I felt I was there at the end, but I kind of missed the middle. I kind of missed the salad days. You know, I remember in like 2000, 2001, you know, when I walked into Suncoast and there was an entire anime section, I was just like, wow, you know, we did it, you know, game, you know, it's, it, we did what we set out to do. You know, this has gone gone mainstream, and it was on TV, and, you know, Pokemon, for better or worse, was a huge hit, and DVDs were selling like crazy, and I kind of missed all that. You know, I saw it as a spectator because I was off doing comics, and I was happy for the industry. And when I came back, as you astutely point out, it was unfortunately when things were starting to wane again. So when I took over in marketing, I mean, it was still not, it wasn't like, you know, the industry wasn't in any kind of nosedive, but you could definitely feel that the DVD sales weren't where they had been in 2000, 2001. The market was changing rapidly, obviously piracy in the internet, which is, a tired subject, but that was definitely having an impact. And fans were changing too. I mean, there was a whole culture of fans that weren't in it to collect DVDs or to necessarily own the shows. They were in it to cosplay. It was a total social dynamic. I mean, they were going to conventions and not even really attending the convention. They were just hanging out in the lobby, taking pictures of each other in costumes. So there was definitely a whole thing happening. And we kind of tried to respond to that by doing different things. And one of those things we did was, for example, diversifying our portfolio, and specifically getting into more of the Moe titles like Haruhi and K-On. And that was a very conscious choice, and stuff that normally you would just not associate with Bandai Entertainment, who had always been known for Bebop and Gundam and Escaflowne and those kinds of titles. And when we got Haruhi, people were just totally shocked. Everyone's like, oh, I thought Funimation would have gotten this or someone else, I'm not Bandai. And so we were trying to kind of change what the fans perceived, at least, Bandai Entertainment was. And to some degree, we were successful with that. But the market was definitely, you know, starting to wane. I mean, the retailers were starting to collapse, and, you know, the whole economy collapsed by 2009. So it was ugly for everyone. But yeah, there was definitely a sense of like, okay, how can we reach out to the core and get them excited again about what we're doing?
So let's talk about that a little bit, because that's interesting to me that was a pointed effort to start getting into the Moe stuff. And so it sounds like was it more like, okay, so this is what American fans want? Because at the time, that was also, here's what's popular now in Japan. Like, this is what's being produced. These are the big hits. So that it wasn't necessarily just an organic thing. You would have just stuck with Gundam and, you know, more adult oriented action titles and stuff. But you were specifically trying to get this stuff out to the American fans where you saw it also being more popular.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I think anyone who's in a Region 1 anime company is looking at the trends always, you know, what's selling, what's popular. There's a constant reevaluation of what titles you should go after and why. So yeah, absolutely. That, you know, those things were popular in Japan. There was certainly Haruhi was like a phenomenon in Japan, and so we were very excited to acquire it. And there was a very strong fandom for it here. So yeah, it wasn't strictly just like, okay, let's go into Moe for the hell of it. It was definitely these are popular titles. You know, let's go after them. But also a byproduct of that is, hey, this is going to kind of change our face a little bit. And that's probably a good thing, you know, to mix it up and not just be known as the Gundam, you know, Cowboy Bebop company, but to be known for some more diverse content. So we were excited to do that. And from a marketing standpoint, as everyone knows, for better or worse, we did some wacky things like with the Haruhi videos and things like that. And that was all pretty fun to do, and definitely generated the kind of response we were hoping for, which has got people talking. And some people are like, I can't believe they're doing this. This is ridiculous. This is awful. And some people are like, I love this. So that was fun.
Now, hopefully you can confirm or deny this. I was always told that Haruhi underperformed. It didn't do the numbers that they, at least maybe the home office, wanted it to do here. Is that true?
Well, this again goes back to Star Blazers Mountain and that analogy, which is a constant thread, I think, between Japanese companies and the American market. And that is the overestimation of what something simply because it's popular in Japan, what it can do in the United States. There's just this, you know, so people like Kenny Adomi get it. People like Seiji Horibuchi get it. People like Henry Goto of Aniplex get it because they really understand the American market. But there are folks in Japan and licensors in Japan who just simply don't get it. And they think because something performs X in Japan, it can be replicated in the United States. And, you know, that began with the Star Blazers Mountain, maybe with Haruhi, and I'm sure it's still going on today. And it's such an odd thing because you would think after all this time, you know, more people in Japan would be more savvy to what's going on here. But I think it just boils down to the fact that the American market is just an afterthought. And I know fans don't like to hear that, but it's really true. I mean, a lot of these companies just they just don't care, you know, so much about how things perform in the U.S. Either they don't care or they want it to sell exactly what it sells in Japan. So it's just this very bizarre kind of polarizing extreme view. And in reality, it's always somewhere in the middle. It's going to do okay, but it's never going to equal a Japanese release, just because this is a different market and you're dealing with a different set of fans. You know, piracy is not what it is in Japan. You know, they still are buying two episodes on Blu-ray for $60-$70 of some titles, and you're just not going to replicate that in the U.S. So, long answer. I don't know if Haruhi was particularly considered as underperforming. I never really heard that, and the folks at Kadokawa always seemed, you know, pretty pleased with what we had done. But yeah, sure, it didn't sell as well as it did in Japan, but would it have ever? Probably not.
No, of course not. And that's sort of what I was gonna try and clarify next, which is like, so basically, the home office expects it to move 50,000 units per volume. And you guys report a number of, I mean, can you give us a number? I maybe don't remember, but like what were like volume one sales?
I mean, and again, I'm generalizing a lot,
sure,
you know,
sure.
So there's plenty of people in Japan who get where the American market's at because they see the numbers and they're like, oh, okay, that only sold, you know, whatever, 10,000. We thought it was going to sell 50, you know, whatever it is. And I wasn't in sales per se. I mean, Sam Maseba was more the core guy in Ken that dealt with those numbers. But I just believe philosophically part of the problem or part of the bizarre equation of being a Region 1 anime company is trying to satisfy the licensor expectations. And that's not always possible. And it's seldom possible, to be honest. But it's not like everyone ever would come around and say, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe how little this sold. I mean, we wouldn't get those kinds of emails, but I think there was always the hope that somehow you could take a title that was a phenomenon in Japan and recreate that in the US. And I just think it's sort of unrealistic.
So in other words, the expectations are out of whack to the point where even a success for you guys, where you guys would look at the numbers and go, holy hell, like, this is a big hit for us. You're always going to get disappointment, a little bit of disappointment, maybe masked from the home office.
Well, that's my personal opinion. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of how I see things. You know, I think the expectations are often based on a lack of knowledge of, you know, the what the marketplace can really do here. And then there is the occasional opposite, like when, you know, we released, when Bandai Visual USA had been merged into Bandai Entertainment and we released Akira on Blu-ray under the Oniyama's label, that actually did better than everyone expected. So there are those occasional different examples, but I think in general, what I'm trying to say is I feel personally, me, Robert, not speaking for anyone else, that there's a bit of a disconnect between Japanese companies and the American market. And there always has been. And I'm not sure, I don't pretend to have the answer, you know. And again, it's an afterthought of a market for them. So maybe that's just where it needs to always be. until we can sell 100,000 copies of something the equivalent of the way it's sold in Japan. Maybe that's what it'll always be here. But I think it's disappointing. I mean, this gets toward the end of the conversation, but I'll leave it for later. But, you know, definitely where things are at now is interesting to me, having been there at the beginning and kind of observed the middle and then watched the end.
Right. So when you come into 2005, 2006, and you mentioned Bandai Visual at Oniyami's. And I had heard nothing but sort of contentious stories about how exactly that went down. And since you were presiding over that, what was it like going through that? Tell us what that period was like.
Well, I'll be totally honest, and I'm going to give the positive answer first.
Okay.
I really mean this. The Bandai Visual USA experience, for me personally, turned out to be a great thing, because when we absorbed Bandai Visual USA into Bandai Entertainment, we inherited two really, really outstanding people, Mr. Ori, who's no stranger to ANN, and Loy Farrell, who was the marketing guy at Bandai Visual USA and became someone who I worked with hand in hand at Bandai Entertainment. And Loy just brought a whole energy that was great, and an expertise that was great, and an enthusiasm that was great. And so having those two guys on board was fantastic. And that would have never happened had it not been for Bandai Visual USA. So in the plus column, that was a big plus, because they became very, very important parts of, at least for me, it was great to have a kind of help in the form of Loy. And someone who was really interested in the things I wasn't, in terms of marketing, like social media and the different things that were important, but I just didn't have time for. So he really took over that stuff. Now, as a corporate strategy, it made no sense to me whatsoever. Right. I didn't understand it then. I don't understand it now. I get why someone would want to do high end collectible editions, box sets, expensive of anime. Aniplex of America has proven the last couple of years that that's very doable. The difference between what Aniplex has done and what Bandai Visual USA did is the titles. Aniplex has titles that are kind of highly coveted and desirable. They're not trying to go to the masses with it. And I think the two mistakes Bandai Visual USA made were that the titles they launched with were not strong enough. And they made the mistake of doing a deal with Image Entertainment to distribute to the major retail stores like Best Buy, because sending those high-end box sets to, you know, stores like Best Buy just made no sense to me whatsoever, because you're going to sell very few. Everything you don't sell is going to get damaged in the shipping back and forth. And people don't realize how much shrinkage there is when you ship out, say, 10,000 units, you know, how many get crushed, cracked, torn, shredded, ripped. So anime fans who are probably the pickiest fans are not going to want to spend $200 on a box set that's come back that's been, you know, dinged up. So I think those strategically, in my opinion, again, only in my opinion, were two moves that didn't make a lot of sense. They tried something. It was an experiment. It was frustrating because it created a lot of confusion, I think, for the company as a brand. It's like DC Comics. You know, they release a Batman comic in what's called a floppy, which is just like a 22-page print comic. Then they collect it in a trade paperback. And then if it's really important, like a Watchmen, they'll do like the Watchmen Absolute edition, which is a big $70 box set. And DC does all of that. They don't like, okay, we're going to start a different division to only do the box sets. So I think it confused the consumer, and it sort of diluted the brand Bandai to have two companies suddenly and not really understanding how they were interacting. It confused conventions like crazy, which was a huge headache for me. I used to get their bills all the time from conventions. And I was like, no, that's not us. That's the other Bondi over there. And we used to get their inventory delivered to our booth, you know, and things like that. And that was just kind of, for me personally, because I'm the one who had to straighten those confusing things out, that was kind of a headache. But like I say, at the end of the day, the idea of trying to sell high-end collectors' sets, I think, is valid. And I think, again, Aniplex has proven it can be done. But, you know, Aniplex is doing it the right way. They're going to – it's a very niche thing. It's almost going back to what Books Nippon was doing with VHS tapes. You know, you're selling a small quantity to your core consumer through online vendors, yeah, and you're not trying to take it to the masses. And so I think – That's not an unreasonable thing to attempt. I just think it wasn't the right time, and maybe wasn't done in the right way, in my humble opinion.
Well, that blows my mind a little bit to hear you say that one of the big mistakes was going with Image, because I remember being at the big launch party for this at the Beverly Hilton, and I told the story a little while ago, but. They were real proud of that. They were very, very proud of that deal with Image. And they had half the presentation was, we've got Image. They're going to distribute these titles. And the way they were talking was, oh, we're going to blow the lid off this business. And, like, I can't believe we're going to get into all these different retail locations. And then they showed a reel of what they were going to release. And I can remember thinking, not with that stuff, you're not.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's not, and it's no fault of Image. Any trying to take that stuff, I think, to mass retail through anyone on any level would have been an error. Especially as I agree with those titles, they just, you know, Pat Labor, God love Pat Labor, but I just don't think it was an appropriate title to try that with. If they had launched with Akira or something like that,
yeah.
You know, yeah, that would have made more sense. But I think the combination of the titles they launch with and then the ambition. And to me, again, the ambition goes back to Star Blazers Mountain. It's that disconnect of, like, not really grasping what this market is and what it can be. And I do think there was a sense of, like, oh, we can blow the lid off this thing. And I was kind of like, okay.
Good luck.
Kind of like good luck, you know. I mean, if you guys do it, I'll be the first to be like, okay, wow, you know. I certainly underestimated the American market, but when it didn't happen, I wasn't surprised. Again, though, yeah, I will stress that I'm glad it happened, because you know, we got a couple great people out of the deal, and Oniamis with Akira and with Gundam Unicorn was actually pretty successful. So yeah, it's just, you know, not maybe handled the way it should have been handled, in my opinion.
So during all of this, you're still handling business as usual under the regular label. And during that time, you know, 2005, 2006, maybe 2007 into 2007, what were the big titles for you? Like, what was all of your attention focused on?
Let me think for a minute. Well, Code Geass was a huge title. And a show I actually really, really liked. And it was always great when you could get behind marketing shows that you really believed in.
Right.
Geass was great. Haruhi was great. Personally, I'm trying to remember. Gurren Lagann, that was actually the funnest moment I ever had as director of marketing, is when, you know, God rest her soul, ADV, fell on their face. And I say that because, you know, we the same thing happened to us. So I'm not dancing on anyone's grave. But when, for whatever reason, they could not release Gurren Lagann and we acquired it, I just leaked it to everyone, including your guys' supreme leader, Chris McDonald. I said, you definitely want to be at our panel at New York Comic Con. And I went through the panel at the very end. I said, okay, I have one more trailer to play, and I'm just going to play it. I'm not going to say anything. And I played the Gurren Lagann trailer, and the gaffes that went around the room was pretty funny. And that was kind of an amazing moment, just to dump that on everyone. And people came running into the room like, oh, my God, I can't believe they rescued Gurren Lagann. So that was pretty fun. And Gurren was a major title for us. And we were lucky enough to get the manga, which was a really great looking manga. The art was really impeccable. And, you know, some of the manga adaptations of anime, to be honest, they look a little dumped out sometimes. But like Eureka 7 and Gurren were two of the best. I mean, they put top-notch talent on it. And that was a fun period. So I would say Haruhi, Kogias, Gurren. Girl Who Leapt Through Time is one of my personal favorites, just because I think it's such a sweet story and just kind of a beautiful film. You know, Summer Wars, obviously, he went on to do, which is also great. I think we had a pretty good catalog. I mean, the thing was that was interesting is as the market started to retract, we had to be a little more picky choosy mm-hmm. than maybe in the old days before I got to Bandai. So, you know, most of the titles we got were either kind of what we would call A titles or like A minus B plus titles. You know, you just didn't have kind of filler titles to kind of build out the catalog for the year. So I think we had a good lineup and it was fun trying to promote that stuff.
Briefly on the Gurren Lagann thing, I think this is a story that is largely forgotten. I don't think people remember really what happened with that. So ADV ostensibly licensed it and dubbed a bunch of it. They dubbed like 4 or 5 episodes, something like that, right? I don't know.
You know, as far as I know, yes. Right. They did start dubbing it.
And they that got shown somewhere. I think they were
they released one volume,
right?
Very briefly.
Oh, you know, you're right. Months. Yeah, actually, you're right, Justin. They did.
And then their shit just fell apart, and that reverted back to you. I don't think people really remember that.
Yeah, it was high drama. You know, I mean, they released it, and then they couldn't continue. And I honestly don't know. I mean, I never asked what happened, and I was on several panels, and I was instructed to say. When I got the question you just asked, for business reasons, ADV is not continuing with the title. That was the official statement I was supposed to say. And that's all I know. But yeah, we were, the hard thing was one of the criteria for rescuing it was getting it out really fast. So production had to go into overdrive to get it released. That was a big challenge for, definitely that was a fun moment I'll never forget because people were so shocked that we were showing the Gurren Lagann trailer.
So now, go ahead, Justin.
Well, one thing about Gurren Lagann is that you guys made probably for the reason you just stated the you know needing to get it out quick. You guys put it out all subtitled only first, and then came out with a bilingual disc. Do you think that hurt sales? Did it help? Or what do you think the effect of that was?
Well, you're absolutely right. The reason we did that was because we had to, and we told everyone this. This is not some kind of big secret. I mean, maybe it never made circulated this, but I said this at many, many a panel, and we even put out a press release saying we're going to release it subtitled only now, and later it will probably be dubbed because we need to get it out by a certain date. So we made no secret of that, and I was kind of astonished when people got pissed that it came out later dubbed, because we made a lot of noise about that. There was one guy who just relentlessly would call Bandai, some fan that was just, I mean, he wanted blood when the dub version came out, and I got on the phone with him. He demanded to talk to Ken at one point. Ken got on the phone with him, and there was nothing we could say to this guy. I sent him a copy of the PR, you know. I mean, he was just furious. So, I mean, but that was one guy, you know. But again, the vocal minority. You know, I don't think it was the ideal situation, but that was such a bizarre situation. And then what happened, of course, was Sci-Fi wanted it. Sci-Fi Channel wanted it, and so we had to dub it for them, even though that was always the plan. You know, to meet the broadcast demands, we needed to have it dubbed. So, you know, that was a uniquely bizarre situation. I mean, if we'd gotten in the title from the beginning, I doubt we would have released it with a sub version only and then followed by a dub version. But that's kind of the way it went down.
Were there any titles during this period that you had in your lap and you were like, oh boy, like, what do I do with this?
Trying to think if there were...
Because you were Clockwork getting fighters.
You were getting, you know, it's funny. God, Justin, psychic.
Yeah.
Kind of scary. I was literally Hiwasenki was on my tongue. That was, you know, I'm not gonna say it's a bad show because, you know, I don't wanna knock bones because I love them. But it was a cursed show. We just had so much trouble getting it done for various reasons. There were all kinds of issues with the production materials, and it literally just dragged on and on and on. I think we released it in four parts over a period of, like, I want to say 10 years. No, I'm kidding. It was a long time, though. So, yeah, that was definitely a challenging title. The Gundam questions would always get on my nerves. I mean, this isn't specific to a title, but just like, when are you going to release G Gundam? When are you going to release Turn A Gundam? When are you going to release Double Zeta? You know, I would get that question 1,000 times a day at a convention. And I'm like, well, you know, talk to Sunrise. I mean, it was up to us to an extent. But, you know, Sunrise really controls Gundam. We didn't control Gundam. So, but we kind of have to answer for it. And I love it whenever we were at Anime Expo, because there would always be someone from Sunrise in the audience, you know, poor Akane or someone. And whenever I'd get that question, I'd be like, well, you know, Akane's sitting over there. Why don't we ask her? You know, I'd dump it on her. But she was always kind of sweet about that. So a bit of a tangent. I realize I'm not answering the question, but it just, the titles we didn't release are the ones I would kind of hear the most about versus releasing titles that, you know, underperformed, you know, for the fans or weren't considered that great. It was just like, when are you going to do this? When are you going to do that? And probably one of the saddest things about when Bandai Entertainment was basically shuttered is we were just about to release Turn A Gundam. And I had arranged an interview with Sid Mead. You know, I live in Pasadena and Sid lives about 2 minutes from my house. And I had met Sid with Kenny Adomi back at LA Hero. So I emailed him. I mean, I'm also a huge Blade Runner fan. So I emailed him and I just said, Sid, you know, we're going to finally release Turn A Gundam, and I'd love to come and interview you. So Taku and Loy and Nobu Masuda and I went over to Sid's house, and we did this amazing interview, and he busted out all the sketches and artwork from Turn A Gundam, and we shot all these inserts of all this stuff. And we were going to make this amazing, you know, little mini documentary that was going to go on our Turn A Gundam release, just explaining how he got into it, being kind of the first American to come in and really redesign a hero ship. I mean, he had done it with Yamato, but you know, the Gundam thing was so big. And then, of course, unfortunately, Turn A Gundam was never released. So I have the only copy of that interview on my computer.
Oh, wow. How far did you guys get? Like, was the first volume done, or like?
I think it had. We hadn't gotten very far.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately, so that was part of why it didn't make the cut, you know, so to speak, before some of those acquisitions were canceled. It's a shame, you know. It's a good show, and one I would have liked to have silenced the fans about.
Yeah, really. Well, because, like, I you know, having sat in my fair share of Bandai panels over the last 10 years, once the Gundam stuff started coming out, I remember exactly what you're talking about, where the panel questions would be, let's list every single Gundam show that you haven't released yet and ask you when it's coming out. And it was tedious. Like, I never understood how you had the patience for that. It was just ridiculous. I mean, God bless the hardcores. Like, God bless them for being so in love with the show. But that must have been just a giant headache, being responsible for 30 years of Gundam material that this select group of maybe 200 really obsessive dudes want all of right now.
Yeah, I mean, definitely you got to love people's passion. I mean, I always would try to remember, I'd always say to myself before I do a panel, you know, whatever it is, I mean, you really love Doctor Who, so try to sympathize, you know, or whatever it is, because I do like Doctor Who. So I would try to think, okay, you know, what's the question I would want to ask, you know, and that's all they want. It's nothing personal. But yeah, it would get pretty damn tedious. And Gundam was a complex thing, and it still is, because Gundam is a phenomenon in Japan, and it is not a phenomenon in the U.S. You know, Gundam Wing was the peak. Unfortunately, I don't think it's ever come back to the level of Gundam Wing in terms of the awareness. You know, Gundam Wing was on TV. There were toys and Toys R Us. I mean, you know, everyone kind of thought like, okay, this is it. Gundam, this is the tipping point. And unfortunately, I think following that up with the original Gundam broadcast kind of sent it a step back. You know, that's, again, just my personal opinion. I wasn't there. I wasn't at the company yet when all that happened. But yeah, Gundam's a huge challenge because it's so so big in Japan. It's the reins to Gundam are held very tightly. Mm-hmm. And so the fans here would not understand, well, why can't you just release Double Zeta and da da da, and you know, it just wasn't up to us. I mean, there was a strategy and a procedure about Gundam that really, again, I kind of make the same analogy. It's the Star Blazers mountain. You know, in Japan, Gundam is a mountain. It's a huge mountain. It's Star Wars, you know, but over here it's not. You know, over here it's Star Wars. it's not Gundam. So there's a little bit of a disconnect, and it makes it difficult to roll out some of those old titles because it's really, you know, it's tightly controlled.
Would licensors and you know, the parents of these giant properties in general get angry at Bandai for not being able to do numbers that, you know, they would expect of a giant blowout hit?
Well, I don't want to say angry, and again, those are kind of the conversations that Kenny Adomi would have, and so I wasn't privy to some of those. I think there was a frustration for them that they couldn't, you know, maybe do the same things in the U.S. that they were able to do in Japan with certain titles. And, you know, we would just say, well, look, the market doesn't bear it, you know, simple as that. Come over and check it out for yourself. If you don't believe us, you know, there's X amount of fans. They'll spend X amount of dollars buying X amount of titles. And keep your expectations realistic. But, you know, it's kind of a theme, I guess, I'm harping on. But I think that is probably kind of one of the big stumbling blocks of trying to be an anime company in the U.S. Is you have to try to cater to a market that's very different from the home market, and you're a middleman, and you're on opposite sides of two forces that don't necessarily think alike. You know, being Japanese licensors and American consumers, so navigating those waters is extremely challenging, and Gundam is probably one of the most challenging. I mean, you have no idea how many people from Hollywood would call me because I was the marketing guy from Fox and from, you know, you name it. Every studio I think I talked to at least once, like, hi, I'm blah, blah, blah from blah, 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 and I'm interested in acquiring the rights for Gundam to do a live-action movie. Do you think you could help me? And I would just kind of laugh, you know? and send them to poor Masuda-san, whose job it was to actually answer those questions. But I was like, yeah, dude, let me save you some trouble. They're never going to let a Hollywood studio run with Gundam. It's just not going to happen. But if you want to explore this, talk to this gentleman, Nobuo Masuda, and maybe he can help you out, you know? And so anyway, it's just kind of
help direct you to the wall.
Yeah, he can. Yeah. And just wait for the no. That's what I would always say. Just wait for the no.
Well, so while we're on Gundam, aside from Gundam Wing, which we all know was a big success, and it's funny you mentioned that's the peak. Yeah, it was also where that franchise started in the U.S. So kind of like it never quite, you know, made as big a splash as it did when it very first came out here.
Absolutely.
And so aside from Wing and aside from Gundam Unicorn, which you mentioned and we all know was did well. were any of the Gundam shows a hit for you guys? Were any of them like, okay, this is a prime thing. We really gotta, like, this is bringing in the numbers.
You know, Gundam would always kind of perform at a certain, there was kind of an expectation of a certain number that we could always hit, you know, whatever that number may have been. So to some degree or lesser degree, it was always like a performer, but not a great performer. I mean, the greatest performer we ever had was Cowboy Bebop. I mean, that was an evergreen. It's still an evergreen. It'll always be an evergreen. You know, Escaflowne and Outlaw Star and, you know, Jerry touched on this, so I probably don't need to recite that. But, those were the big, big titles for us. Gundam was always okay. It was never stellar. It was never terrible. And to some degree, certain series did better than others. I mean, Gundam Seed did okay. Gundam Seed Destiny, I seem to think, not as well. Gundam 00, which a lot of people liken to Gundam Wing, did okay. You know, Unicorn actually did pretty well and continues to do pretty well. I think that one is probably the best sellers, and certainly one that the fans seem to have embraced quite a lot. And that was, of course, released on the Oniamas label on Blu-ray with an English track for the U.S. So I would say that was probably the closest to something that we felt was, you know, maybe going to break out a little bit.
Right. But overall, so it sounds like it was reliably mediocre sales that, you know, you wouldn't lose money, but you're not really making money on it, maybe.
Yeah, you wouldn't lose money. And I mean, we might be making money, but it wasn't stellar. It wasn't a Bebop, you know, for example, which was obviously the kind of high mark. For us as a catalog title.
Do you think that that early success with Cowboy Bebop, which is, you know, I don't know if it, I mean, obviously maybe Dragon Ball outstrips it and maybe a couple other titles, but probably one of the best-selling anime titles in the U.S. of all time. That was a very early title for Bandai. That was, you know, early 2000s, late 90s, and do you think that that early success led to the kind of out-of-control expectations for what everything else would do? It's kind of a pattern that I'm seeing here.
That's an interesting question, which I've never really considered.
Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, Bebop, I mean, it's just such a damn good show, you know? It was such a special show. It was... the writing was so good. The music was so good. The dub was so good. Actually, one of my favorite moments was when I watched Bebop, because all the people on Bebop were the people I started with in the hillside on Orgus and Guyver. I mean, it was Yutaka Maseba and Zero Limit. It was Kevin Seymour of Animes. It was Steve Bloom. It was Melissa Fawn. And I remember watching it just feeling, you know, so proud of them, because we always knew the talent was there and that you could create a U.S. dub that would rival the original Japanese. That was always the goal. And I felt Bebop was the first show for me that really did that, where I was like, God, this is just so well done. All the parts just work so perfectly. So I don't know if that created a false expectation. I think everyone kind of got on to the idea pretty quickly. That was just a really special show that really appealed to the U.S. audience. And frankly, Cartoon Network gets a huge, you know, chunk of the credit, because they literally showed those same 26 episodes for like 6 years. It was never off the air, I think, for 6 or 7 years. They would just repeat it over and over and over. So new people would discover it, and then they would want the DVD. So that was a really special show. So I don't know if that created false expectations or not. That's tough to answer. But I do think that boom period of 2000-2001, when Bebop was happening, I think definitely, I think the industry in Japan was like, oh, this is really happening. And, you know, money, they started raising the prices to acquire shows. And there was definitely a money grab going on maybe in Japan a little bit about the U.S. market, because I heard from everyone. I wasn't there at Bandai, but I heard from everyone and people at other companies that the prices to acquire shows really skyrocketed during that period. And of course, they came down again in the 2005-2006 era. Yeah, I think we all felt like, okay, maybe anime is kind of tipped over and it's going to go big, and then it didn't. you know, really it kind of retracted back to where it had been.
So during this period, now maybe this was a little bit before your time. I'm not sure if you can comment on this, but I remember hearing a story, speaking of things being on TV and on Cartoon Network and being a hit. I had always heard that Bandai was one of the companies playing ball with Cartoon Network in terms of paying to get TV shows on the air. And the first example of that I heard about was Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex. Can you tell us anything about that? Was that a practice that was happening at the time? Because I had heard this from so many different places that Bandai was basically paying to get their shows on the air, which is why so many of them did manage to make it on Cartoon Network.
You know, I can honestly say I don't know the answer to that question because I really wasn't there, and dealing with Cartoon Network was not my turf.
Right.
I don't think I ever met with anyone from Cartoon Network the entire time I was at Bandai. It just wasn't I wasn't in the licensing broadcast side. So I have to say I don't know.
Interesting. Speaking of Ghost in the Shell, how did that perform for you guys? Because I always got the impression that maybe it did better than a lot of other things, but everyone was always like, well, kind of wish this did better than it did.
Ghost was, again, another solid performer. I mean, we're partnered with Manga on that title.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on TV. I mean, anything on TV would do pretty well. You know, it's that simple adage. You know, it was great advertising to be able to go to Adult Swim and see these shows. It was great advertising for your DVD. And so, yeah, anything that was broadcast tended to sell better, for sure, than things that weren't broadcast. So I would say Ghost in the Shell was up there. I don't know the precise numbers.
Right.
And it was a good show. And that was another show that almost quasi went mainstream with the first movie and,
right.
You know, got the limited theatrical run and people started kind of talking about it in the mainstream along with Akira, that it was this cool cyberpunk thing. And I think you two did the soundtrack or something. So Ghost in the Shell was definitely a strong performer.
So, moving past the middle part of the decade, now we're sort of getting into the end times here for Bandai.
The end of days.
The end of days. But before we do that, here's one thing that I really want to get into. This has always been a canard or something that people have always thrown out there, and I never had any reason to doubt it, but at the same time, I don't actually know what it was like. So everybody assumes that Bandai Entertainment USA was completely under the thumb of Bandai Corporate in Japan, and that you are a wholly owned subsidiary of Bandai Corporate, and you didn't really have a lot of autonomy, but the stories you're telling me sound like you had a lot more autonomy than people maybe might have thought.
Yeah, we did. And I think one of the biggest misconceptions about Bandai, in general, even for me before I started working there, was that Bandai is this big single entity like Disney, you know, and, that's especially after the merger with Namco, that's really not the case. It's a bunch of companies under the umbrella of Bandai that really function independently. You know, Bandai Entertainment was different from Bandai America, was different from Namco Bandai Games, you know, different needs, different requirements, different sales goals, different expectations. So, yeah, that's not really true. I mean, it was a little bit true before the Namco merger. You know, we would kind of work with Bandai. You know, we were kind of part of Bandai America. But specifically after the merger, we were completely independent, which is both good and bad because obviously you kind of sink or swim on your own. But there was always this overriding, you know, authority from Japan, which obviously reared its head when we were, you know, for all intents and purposes, closed down in 2011. That was very much a decision made by corporate, corporate in Japan, not made by anyone in America, as Ken said in his interview right after that happened. So I'm not saying anything that hasn't already been publicly stated. But yeah, it's a big company, but it's a lot of small independent satellites that that act separately from each other. And that's really something that people never got. They're like, oh, you must have so much money and so much this and so much that. You just call Japan and, you know, ask for this and ask for that and you get it. And it's like, no, that's not how it really works.
Well, and to wit, the biggest distinction, and you can correct me if this is wrong, of course, people, I don't think, understood that Bandai, like, you guys had to bid on titles. Shows that were owned by Bandai did not automatically go to you. You had to bid on them. Is that correct? With everyone else?
Yeah, that's correct. And I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, but yeah, absolutely. We never got anything for free. And people, I think, thought that. Like,
yeah, of course Sunrise, they did. Yeah.
Yeah, that Sunrise just would hand us, you know, Gundam and Code Geass, et cetera, et cetera. No, we had to bid just like anybody else. It was tough love, man.
Which sounds kind of crazy. Because you would figure, like, the home office wants you to be profitable. But then, how did that ecosystem even work? So they wanted you to be profitable, and you had to post numbers in order to stay open. But the company capable of just using you as a distribution arm for titles they already owned to make money on were instead requiring that you were profitable enough to pay them for the privilege of releasing their shows.
Yeah, you just summed it up beautifully, better than I could have said it. It was paying for the privilege. Man, and again, maybe it goes back to Star Blazers Mountain.
God, that's weird.
That's just how it was. And
was there any frustration? I mean, were you like, what the hell?
Well, it's, you know, intellectually, yeah. Like you, I'm kind of like, huh, wouldn't it make more sense if, you know, we didn't have to do this? And,
right.
You know, because it's a small market anyway. But hey, man, I think you said it the best. I couldn't say it any better in terms of paying for the privilege. And that's, again, how certain licensors feel about their products. You know, not just America. Every territory should have to pay. It doesn't matter if it's a company, a sister company. If you want it, you got to pay for it. So, but
even if you were only loosely affiliated, these different, you know, Bandai Namco Group companies, I mean, there was some expectation that you should at all opportunities work together, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, there was definitely an advantage there, for sure. You know, because you would be kind of we were kind of the first choice for Gundam, you know, and things like that, because we were within the Bandai group. Absolutely. So that was an advantage. The disadvantage is, as you say, we were kind of treated like everyone else in terms of approaching the titles. And again, there are, you know, not getting into specifics, but there were definitely different ways the relationship could be set up on certain titles and things like that. But generally speaking, if the question you're asking is, did we ever get anything for free from our peers in Japan? The answer is no. And, you know, you got to pay to play, and that's just how it was. But yeah, there was an expectation of us working together on certain things and, you know, trying to, what's that word? Have synergy,
right?
when possible. Wow. So you know, sometimes it was advantage. Sometimes, frankly, it was a disadvantage. I mean, the other question I'd always get at panels: how come Funimation can do this and you guys can't? Well, we answer to different folks, and they have different expectations of what we're doing. You know, and so. We don't necessarily have certain freedoms, you know, that you would think we would have. And those would always be kind of awkward moments, you know, at panels and things like that. When people would ask me those questions, it's like, well, I can't really explain it, but it's just how it is.
And I know you weren't directly involved in licensing, but during that time, the 2005 to about you know, to the bubble fully bursting in about, I'd say 07 is about when things came crashing down. I heard many, many tales of licensing sort of skullduggery, where there's a whole lot of, like, shady stuff and nasty competition going on behind the scenes. Were you privy to any of that? Was that – did that become sort of a source of frustration where it's like, man, we got to play this stupid game and we got to fight with ADV and Funimation, and ADV and Funimation are at each other's throats constantly. So, I mean, were you part of that ecosystem? Was that sort of like – was that a thing?
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely a period of time where – and not any of our sister companies, I can say that hands down, but other third-party companies. It felt like, to me, personally speaking, not speaking for anyone else, that they were using the American companies to jack up the price a little bit. They were playing us off each other. You know, it's like, well, you guys bid this, but, you know, Funimation bid that and ADV bid that. And there was definitely some of that gamesmanship going on, I think. And yeah, that's not pretty. And sometimes we play that game and sometimes we're like, okay, well, you know what? Go take their offer, because we've offered what we think it's worth. And we passed on certain titles and stepped out of certain situations. I know it was because of that. So, you know, that's just business, though. Of course, everyone wants the most for whatever it is they're selling. Right, that's just the nature of business. So I don't think it's – I wouldn't call it shady, but it was definitely gamesmanship, and it was definitely aggressive, you know. Aggressive licensing in the United States was occurring at certain periods of time from some of the licensors.
And you know, if you're willing to comment on this, during this period, you know, in the late part of the last decade, when you saw what your competitors were doing, you know, and Genion went out before you guys did, obviously, and ADV went out before you guys did, were you looking at any of their strategies and going like, what are you guys thinking? Like, what is going on here?
Well, you know, I think it's no secret ADV had a reputation for spending a lot of money on titles, you know, and would buy a lot. And no, we weren't going to play that game. I mean, that was never – we never felt any pressure to, like, compete on that level with any other company. We went for the titles we liked. It really came down to personal preference. I mean, we went for the titles that we thought were good, that we thought would have a success in the U.S., yeah, but there were certainly times where you were looking at someone kind of hearing about the amount of money they were spending and thinking, how do they possibly think they can sell enough units on DVD to recoup what they're spending? You know, are they just buying it to buy it? Are they buying it to have market share? Are they buying it for bragging rights? I mean, these are the kind of things I would think about.
right. Yeah. Well, you can't help it, you know.
Yeah. And I don't know what the answer is. You know, everyone had their own business and they had their own approach to the business. Our approach was always pretty conservative. And even with that, you know, obviously the rapid contraction of the market, you know, hit everyone hard. You know, obviously the music business tanked. You know, Tower Records was gone, Virgin was gone, Suncoast was gone, Borders was gone. You know, in a very rapid succession, you had a lot of channels collapse, and suddenly you had Best Buy and you know, Target was never viable for anime when we tried and others tried. Walmart was never really that viable, because they would take a lot and send a lot back. So, you know, everyone had their own strategy, and we all kind of would look at each other, I'm sure, and kind of question certain things and sort of applaud certain things. But, you know, I, for the guys on the ground like me, I never felt any kind of weird, you know, as I mentioned, like guys like Lance and Adam at Funimation, they're friends. And I would see them in the month of July, I would see them more at conventions than I'd see my own family. So you kind of became, you know, brothers in arms, because you all shared the same frustrations, successes, headaches, you know, and you could relate to each other. So I never felt any kind of weird like competition or Chad at Genyon is he actually took over Books Nippon from Kevin and myself after we left. And
oh, wow.
That was how he got started and actually met his wife there, who I used to work with at Books Nippon. So, you know, there was a lot of camaraderie between the people on the ground. I can't speak for the corporate camaraderie, but the people on the ground got along. And we were never, ever, ever, ever happy when a company would close, because it was just another indicator that the market had taken another step back. So when ADV and Genyon, you know, would fail, and that was a sad day. And I'm sure others felt that way when Bandai Entertainment closed.
So when was the writing on the wall for you? Like, was it when Genyon went down? Was it when ADV went down? Like, what were you, because the ADV thing was kind of a special circumstance. Genyon, I feel like, was a more classic case of, well, we overreached and failed. You know, I guess you could say the same thing about ADV, but like, when was the writing on the wall for you? When were you starting to think, maybe time to start looking for another gig?
Well, it's really interesting because to this day, I mean, I've been out of Bandai Entertainment for just over a year now. I left in January of 2011. And to this day, I'm very surprised and don't understand. And we weren't privy to the decision making that went on in Japan, but I'm very surprised that the powers that be in Japan were willing to give up a foothold in the U.S. as dramatically as they did when Bandai Entertainment was, for all intents and purposes, you know, unplugged. It didn't come as a surprise to me that, okay, people are getting laid off. I mean, we'd gone through one restructure, I think in 2009, where certain producers and other staff members were laid off. You know, the market was just not doing well. The sales were definitely not doing well, compared to where they had been. And, so I wasn't startled so much about, that they were asking some of us to leave, but I was very startled and continue to be startled by Bandai Japan's willingness to basically throw in the towel on the U.S. market. And that should, you know, I'm not sure people really got that when we were, when what happened with us. I mean, maybe they did. Maybe I'm selling people short. But I was like, guys, this is a major event. This is a major Japanese supplier of content, anime content, basically throwing in the towel on the U.S. market. And that should have been pretty alarming to everyone. And I'm not sure it really was. I think they just saw it as another company folding, you know, like ADV or Genyon. And to me, it's an indicator of a much bigger thing, which is the market has really returned back to where it was when I was at Books Nippon. You know, it's companies like Aniplex selling a very targeted product to a very targeted consumer. You know, obviously Funimation is still holding their own, so that's great. You know, fortunately, I think for them, they had Dragon Ball to kind of keep, you know, churning out as a catalog title, a very, very strong evergreen title. But the market has really, really gone back to the beginning. And I think, you know, when we were told what was happening with Bandai Entertainment, I think that was kind of a sad thing. Not only, you know, the team is breaking up because we're a close group, and obviously, I've worked for Kenny Adomi twice in my life, you know, long time ago. And then I got another opportunity. And, you know, he's been a mentor and a friend for me, really, my whole career. So it was definitely sad that we all had to say goodbye. But the bigger thing for me was that what did it mean for the industry? And I don't think it meant anything particularly good, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, that's obviously this is a big part of the story that we really wanted to hear was Bandai Entertainment USA was not necessarily a failure as a company. And from what I understood, you weren't unprofitable. It's not like the business was failing. It just wasn't doing was no longer doing, or it never did. Maybe they just lost faith or something like that. But it was the Japanese corporate office just yanking the plug.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty shocking. You know, it's basically waving the white flag.
Do you think that was premature? Do you think it was unfair?
I think it was premature and unwise, ultimately. Unfair, you know, that's a tough question.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, you know.
Is the market, did the market retract? Absolutely. You know, was it fair for them to reassess their stance in the market? Sure. Of course it was fair because the market had retracted. But I just think to basically give up their footprint was in the U.S. was a pretty radical, from my personal opinion, was kind of a radical decision. And, you know, what are they going to do with certain titles now? I mean, I know what's happening to some titles, but there are others. And I wonder if they're going to have a home or a venue in the U.S., you know. I don't know what the strategy is, if it's to just do a English subtitle track on Japanese releases and leave it at that, as the case of certain Bandai Visual titles. I don't know. But it seemed to me that it's a big retreat from the U.S. market, which I think is unfortunate because obviously all of us who started way back when – you know, put a lot of effort in trying to build this market up and, you know, to kind of see it all go back to where it was, was a little disheartening for me. And so when we were told, you know, it was going to be time to go, I sort of took it as just, you know, I had mixed feelings about it personally, but you know, for what it meant for me, you know, obviously, as I said, I was sad to say goodbye to my comrades and the people I worked for and with, but I was also kind of ready. I think, you know, which is something I didn't know until it happened. I actually, it's kind of that moment in high school or college where you're like, okay, yeah, I'm never coming back here. You know, and there's that mixture of sadness, but also kind of relief that there's closure. There's a definite end to it. You kind of know what the end is. So it was a very interesting experience, something I've never gone through because I've never, you know, when I left the first time, Books Nippon and LA Hero, that was of my own choice. And as I said, that was hard, but I made the decision to leave to pursue a career of writing comic books. But this time I was asked to leave. So I kind of felt like the anime industry and I are even, because I think when I left the first time, I left sort of abruptly and, you know, as a young guy, and I think I handled it clumsily in a lot of ways. And I was grateful I got a chance to come back and reconnect with all those people that I had known, like the Toshi Yoshidas and Trish Ledoux and just the so many people that I had known in those days that I got to reconnect with. And then to be asked to leave again or to be asked to leave was kind of an interesting feeling. And I kind of felt like, OK, yeah, it's time. It's time to go. This is it for me. I'm not going to be knocking on anyone else's door. I'm not going to be going over to Aniplex or Funimation and giving them my resume. This is over for me, and that's okay. So it was a very interesting period of time.
So in the years leading up to the announcement that, well, you don't have a job anymore, what were you working on then, and was it leading up to the decision that they made? Were fortunes particularly dire? I mean, I know this is during, you know, the economy collapsing and all that, so, like, fortunes were bad for everybody. But also, I feel like during that period, maybe there weren't, like, I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of a big hit show that you guys might have had that was still turning out profit or anything. Like, it seemed like kind of a dead period in general for anime. So, I don't know, maybe that's a misconception, but during that period, those couple of years leading up to the closing of the company, what were you working on, and did you have a lot of faith in any of it?
Well, you know, we did, actually. And, I mean, Kenny Yodomi is a very astute guy who, you know, he was here in 19... I mean, look, I've said this before, and I, you know, it's going to sound a little bit like I'm waxing his car, as the expression goes, but he really was the first guy to come from Japan that believed in the American market. And there were other people at that time, like Carl Masick and others, who were, yeah, anime could be big here. But Ken was the first guy, and Seiji Horibuchi, who came from inside the anime industry to America to specifically create a marketplace for anime in Japan. So, I mean, he's a true pioneer, and he's very astute about this market. So as things, as the writing began to appear on the wall, he was pretty savvy about, retracting, taking certain clients and kind of limiting how much inventory they could have and things like that. For example, like when Borders failed, we didn't take such a big hit from that because he anticipated that and we hadn't been shipping a lot of product to them. So there were a lot of moves made to kind of preserve the business and to be conservative and to keep things profitable. We did have titles that performed, during that period. I mean, we had the evergreen catalog titles like Bebop, which just, would continue to sell year after year. And we would have things like K-On, which was kind of our last big moe, title, mm-hmm. That we rolled out, that did well. So it wasn't a pure decision based on, okay, the bottom line is, these titles aren't selling, because we had done a lot to, again, keep the company profitable. It was simply, I think, a general, like I said, just looking at the trend, the market was declining. And so whoever made the decision in Japan just said, well, this isn't going in the right direction, so why don't we just put the brakes on? But, we did have titles that did okay for us during that time. I mean, like I say, K-On! Was one, and that was kind of a lot of fun to roll out. We put our little band together and did the promotional stuff with Christina V and Stephanie and the voice actresses at the shows. And that was kind of one of our last big pushes, it seemed, before the end.
That story, it just... I have to admit, it's even a little bit more sad, because if you were actually, like, if he anticipated Borders closing, and you guys shored up your manga output as a result, like, you're doing things right, like, you're keeping the lights on, you're making sure the company is still profitable, and to just have that rug just pulled out from under you, it wouldn't happen to any other company like that.
It wouldn't happen if it was your own company.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Ken, if it had just been up to him, obviously Bandai Entertainment would still be doing what it was doing. But to have someone kind of who you didn't know and you weren't really privy to those discussions in Japan kind of throw a dart, and the dart landed in your heart, and that was it. That was a little tough to swallow, versus, we felt we were fighting the good fight. I mean, we really did things to try to maximize what we could do. We were aggressive where we thought we should be aggressive, and we were conservative where we thought we should be conservative. Yeah, I felt we did do the things the right way to try to respond to the market and preserve what we were doing. But somebody looked at the numbers, looked at the trend looked at the overall trend from 2000 to 2011, didn't like the direction it was going, and just said, let's pull back. What's the point of the U.S. market? And that kind of goes back to what I said at the beginning, and that's the conundrum that those I leave behind have to face, and I don't envy him that. And I think it will survive. I mean, I'm not a doomsayer. I know it can be grown back with smart people, passionate people. The market can be grown back, but it's going to be different. And I think it's pretty inconceivable to me that the solid days of the DVD boom in 2000, 2001 will ever return. I mean, I think it's going to be a very different strategy, more reflecting of what the surviving companies are doing now, trying to monetize digital and things like that. So long answer, sorry, but yeah, it's this is something I've literally never talked about, the end of Bandai Entertainment. So I guess a lot of thoughts are coming to my mind, but yeah, I do feel we kind of got cheated a little bit, you know, by someone across the ocean. I can say that. What are they going to do? Fire me again? You know, I do feel we got cheated because we tried hard to, you know, the team that was at Bandai Entertainment worked really hard to keep things going, you know, to keep the dream alive, so to speak. And I think the rug just got totally yanked very arbitrarily. So, you know, but hey, that's life.
Man, that sucks.
Wow.
It just sucks. Like, I...
Well, it is what it is. And like I say, you know, I can't sit here and be like... and honestly say there wasn't a part of me that was like, okay, maybe this is a sign from the universe for me personally. You know, I kind of took it as that. Mm-hmm. I took it as that it was time for me to explore other things that had always still been percolating. I mean, I had always kind of kept my finger, even while I was at Bandai, I'd always sort of kept my finger in the comic book industry and as a writer. And Ken was very tolerant of that, which I always appreciated. While I was at Bandai, I wrote a Battlestar Galactica comic based on the Sci-Fi Channel series just because I loved the show. And, you know, guys I'd worked with when I was just a freelance writer contacted me and said, do you want to write this? And I was like, yeah, you know. And he was really great about stuff like that because I wasn't really competitive with Bandai. So I was able to kind of keep the little back burner alive. And so, you know, I had a place to go when things ended. But yeah, it sucked. It kind of sucked to feel like, you know, we made a lot of sacrifices. We felt we did things right. You know, but I don't know. I guess at the end of the day, someone looked at the numbers and just said, well, numbers don't add up for us. So,
wow. What a story.
And the funny part of the story is, and I don't know if I should tell this, but what the heck? No, it's not that juicy. But literally, we found out right before a convention. And I had to go to that convention 2 days later and pretend like everything was fine and do our panel and see everyone. And that was really hard because I was... you know, the Hulk side of my personality started to come out, and I was not in a good mood at that show. And I yelled at a bunch of people, and I made a lot of very cynical comments. Not on the panel; I was totally cool and so professional. But behind the scenes, in fact, your poor, you know, boss. I mean, I don't know how you guys refer to Chris, but we were at a situation where. We were all kind of hanging out, and I said, you know, I want to say something. And everyone from the team kind of looked at me like, oh no, here he goes. I said, you know, I'm not going to do any anime conventions next year. And Chris McDonald started laughing. He's like, yeah, right, Bob. And then, so I was a little mean because, you know, obviously what I was saying is I won't be back next year. And then I told him later, I was like, yeah, yeah. I don't know if you remember I said this, but what I was saying to everyone is, you know, I'm not going to be back soon. So I was doing stuff like that, which was probably not too mature, but,
who could blame you? Come on. You just found out that the company that you'd worked at for years was getting shut down. Anyone would have been a little cynical.
Yeah. Yeah. I was definitely cynical and it was funny to get the news right before a major convention. So I'll put it that way. But, you know, to their credit, they told us to give us a lot of time to prepare. So it was actually to our benefit that we were told then. But it was just made for awkward timing, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the story is all the more relatable and understandable because of what you expressed earlier, which is it's not like you guys were looking at your numbers and going, shit, we gotta close. We're done. Like, we can't make this business work anymore. You were making the business work. That's that much is clear. Like, it was working. It wasn't... You weren't millionaires, but you were keeping the lights on. So, yeah,
I mean, we did things even like, yeah. I remember when we started exhibiting, you know, that was kind of a decision that we came to together, you know, with Aniplex, like, hey, let's partner up, you know, and do shows together. You'll save some money. We'll save some money. Yeah, it might dilute the brand and confuse people a little, but, you know, let's try it. So, yeah, we would do things like that were very much about, let's be conservative. Let's be responsible. Let's not get a 50 by 50 booth pretending it's 1999. Let's make an impression, but let's make a smaller impression, or look for ways to partner and work together with people. We were very conscious of what needed to be done to kind of sustain things. I do take exception to people who kind of, you know, the vocal minority that was like, well, you know, it's because they didn't do this and they didn't do this and they didn't, you know, have a digital strategy. And we had plenty of digital strategies, but a lot of it was obstructed because, you know, the powers that be in Japan, you know, wouldn't greenlight it. So, you know, there was plenty of things we were trying to do and wanted to do and did do. I'm not sure we got a fair shake. But that's my, you know, that's my take on it.
Incredible. Justin, was there anything? I had one or two, put a button in it questions before we do Twitter, but.
I did too. There was, there were a couple little odd projects that dotted Bandai's history, and I can only assume that most of them came from Japan. But I was wondering if you could tell us the backstory. The first one is the, to my knowledge, the only simultaneous dub to be aired with the show's original airing in Japan, Kurokami.
Right.
Which, full disclosure, I was a limited part of. They had me do some of the finishing work. But why, how, and did that work out?
Well, I think... if I remember correctly, there was a desire on our part to do what we could to combat, you know, the pervasive piracy that was really, really harming, in our minds, the industry. And I know that's a whole can of worm topic and, you know, I don't necessarily want to even, you know, go there, but, you know, it's absolutely true and fair to say that the piracy hurt the American anime industry. I mean, I don't really buy into the argument like, oh, we're just helping promote the show, and by BitTorrenting it a million times, we're actually creating a fan base for it. I just don't buy that argument. I don't want to get into a beef with anyone, but that just doesn't make sense to me as a business model. I think it's a justification for wanting things for free, frankly. So when we did Kurokami, I think it was definitely an attempt to combat, you know, piracy. Okay, like let's do a simulcast and at least attempt to do a day and date. And maybe that'll, you know, start to shift the market. So that was, again, something where I felt we were trying to do do something out of the box and trying to respond to the changes in the market. And to the success that it worked or not, I don't really know. Unfortunately, I think it was a good idea, but I'm not sure Kurokami was a title that really took off. So I think it, maybe with a different title, it might've had a better result. It was certainly difficult, as you know, Justin.
Yes. Yes, I do.
You worked on it and you were part of the nightmare of trying to get that done. I mean, the simulcast is tough, but I do think that may be part of the equation of what could help combat piracy. But ultimately, I don't know. I think piracy is just a behavior that a generation has embraced, and I'm not sure a legal alternative is really the answer, you know, frankly. I wish it were, but I'm not sure that's the case.
The other one I wanted to ask you about was the online retail store that popped up, and I could never really figure out what that was, because it seemed a little half-hearted and, you know, expensive compared to ordering from, say, Right Stuff or Amazon. But it seemed, could you just explain a little bit about what that was and why?
Yeah, I mean, there had always been a desire at Bandai going back. I mean, there was a retail store called Anime Village, which Jerry mentioned when he was on your show.
Right.
And that philosophy was always there. I think when the retail market started to really change, you know, and the store, the Tower Records and the Virgins and the Suncoasts and the Borders were disappearing, there was a desire to go direct to the consumer, you know. Obviously, there was Right Stuff and there were other people already doing that. that, of course, we continued to sell to, but it was to basically try to have an in-house means of distribution. It was a bit of a clunky rollout, I'll put it that way. But I think the desire was a smart one, which was, you know, retail is failing. The fans are still there, so let's try to reach out to them directly. I think with more time, that could have been honed into something more effective. But unfortunately, that was started, you know, I think about a year out from when we got the bad news. So we weren't ever really able to mobilize it in the way that we wanted to. But that was, I think, the idea behind it.
I see.
Wow. Okay. We got questions for you on Twitter. But before we do that, just wanted to get a simple questions. The project that you worked on in your days as director of marketing that you were most proud of.
Let me think about that for a second. God, that's a great question. Well, I'm most proud of the manga division because it was my baby. Literally, I was a division of one. Everyone else was a freelancer in terms of translators and letterers and production people. I built a publishing division from scratch and it became profitable. So I'm very proud of that. And especially because there was so much opposition from licensors in Japan, not opposition, but just a lack of belief that Bandai could be a publisher, a book publisher, because that's not what Bandai is known for. So I feel like I won a small victory there. In terms of the anime, I mean, I definitely feel the whole period of the Moe stuff, like Haruhi, Lucky Star, K-On!, you know, even though it wasn't as hugely successful maybe as we would have wanted, I'm proud of kind of the fact that we changed people's perception of what Bandai Entertainment was. Mm-hmm. And doing all the crazy viral videos, which again, some people thought was ridiculous. Other people thought it was really cool and creative. That was fun that we were trying to think outside the box and mix things up, and make some noise and kind of change people's perceptions. That was definitely a fun period of time for me as the marketing director.
For you personally, I mean, were you into those shows? You seem like more of a sci-fi guy.
Yeah, you know, it's true. It's true, I have to say. you know, Haruhi I really admire because I just think as a writer, it's pretty clever, you know. The execution of the idea as an anime was really well done. Obviously The Endless Eight had its detractors, and we tried to do probably the craziest idea I ever had. I probably shouldn't even talk about this because it upset some people. But on Haruhi season 2, and it wasn't my idea, I can't take credit for it. The craziest idea we ever had was for the Endless Eight. We actually kicked around the idea for each episode. We would do a bunch of episodes with the Haruhi voice cast, and then we'd do a bunch of episodes that were like guest cast. It was almost kind of like the idea of the Star Trek movie reboot, like since it was, you know, a different time, it would be an alternate universe. And so you would have one episode of The Endless Eight that was all Texas, like people who mostly only worked for Funimation would do one episode. And then you would have other people do an episode. And we had the idea, like we would have some of the actors swap roles, like, you know, Johnny would be Kion and Crispin would be Itsuki for one episode. So we pitched this and it all got shot down, and it's probably for the better. Because that probably would have just been a mess. But, you know, as a marketing idea, that was one that I kind of wish we could have done. Unfortunately, some of our cast, when they heard it, they kind of took offense to it, like we were trying to recast them. And I actually had to go around and explain why we thought it would be a cool idea and that it had no bearing on them. But that was part of my role as the director of marketing, was to smooth ruffle feathers. So hopefully I did a good job at that.
Ooh, must have been super fun dealing with voice actors like that.
Oh, you know, I mean, no one wants to hear, oh, hey, we're going to replace you for four episodes.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, everyone's creative people are sensitive, and it didn't get presented to them the right way. So, you know, it was just a life lesson. But anyway, that would have been something fun. I still think that would have been a fun idea for the Endless Eight. And that was something that we kind of pitched, but got shot down. So, you know, that was definitely one I remember.
I don't know. I like that idea.
Yeah, I think it would have been cool, right? You know, and it would have mixed it up. And instead of seeing the same episode, you know, you would have had different actors, and it would have, you know, been kind of a surprise and unexpected. So anyway, I don't know. I thought it was a good idea.
biggest boondoggle.
Oh, wow. Wow. Biggest boondoggle. Gosh, should I even get into this? My
real... Yes, yes, you should.
Oh, it's such a can of worms and a long story. My most unhappy moment was the Haruhi concert at Anime Expo in 2007. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. Did I ever mention the guy I missed most when I came back was Mike Katsugawa?
Enough said.
Infer what you will.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and we got a lot of questions for you on Twitter. I'll skip the stuff we've already covered, obviously. but let's go ahead and get started in on these. Okay. Azabaro asks, are there any series out there, anime shows out there that you regret not being able to work on, and why?
I really liked Soul Eater. I thought that looked like a cool show. I think that went to Funimation. I just thought it was cool. You know, we love Bones. I liked... God, there's one more. I mean, there was a bunch of manga I wanted. In fact, I bid really hard to get the Haruhi manga, and I kind of hoped because we had the anime, we would land it. But my friend Kurt Hassler at Yen Press got that one, to his credit. And Kurt is a friend, so I say that honestly. I didn't begrudge him that. But that was one I really wanted on the manga side that I didn't get. I'm trying to think. I know there's probably others. There's actually a Star Blazers comic I wanted to publish that Tim Eldred did, but the rights are so messed up. We just couldn't touch it. There were some other... Oh, you know, Black Butler was a title I thought was pretty cool. The anime as well as the manga. And I think Funimation got that as well. I don't think we even went after that, but that was just one that in my head would have been a kind of cool to have. I just thought, you know, there was a huge fandom for it, and I definitely thought the manga would be cool to have. So those are some that I remember. But, you know, we got a lot that we wanted to get, like Gurren Lagann and things like that, where we were able to win those battles. So, yeah, it was all evened out.
Okay. we talked about this, obviously. Jaron Namanich asks about the relationship between Bandai Entertainment USA and Bandai Visual USA. But to elaborate on this a little bit, first of all, can you elaborate on it a little bit? And we're separate offices, separate staff. You were not in charge of their titles. They were not involved in what you were doing. These were completely separate, but also similarly positioned entities, right?
Yeah, totally separate. They weren't not even in our building. They had an office in Torrance, completely separated from us, and we did not commingle for a while. You know, like I was pretty lengthy in my comments about that. But yeah, it was confusing, I think, for the fans. It was confusing for the conventions. It was confusing for a lot of people. But at the end of the day, it worked out. We were merged together, or, you know, in a sense, we absorbed them. And like I say, we inherited a couple of great people who became key to our, you know, second half, 5-6 years or 4 or 5 years, whatever it was, Bandai Entertainment. So in the end of the day, it worked out. But, you know, definitely a confusing and strange thing that I'm not sure anyone can fully explain why it was decreed that that would be the best way to go to set up a separate company to do that. But I just wasn't privy to those conversations in Japan, so I don't know why that was decided.
Okay. Tangy Tangerine 2 asks, any titles that you expected to do well that for one reason or another only did decent sales or bombed? And normally we ask about this during the regular interview portion, but Justin and I surely want to know, you know, bombs. Like, what tanked?
See, again, I probably should have been more interested in the sales figures for anime, but I was so focused on the sales figures for manga. I can tell you the manga that bombed was Ghost Slayer Ayashi. I mean, it bombed. I don't know if the anime bombed so much, but I think that was pretty much an underperformer. And it's a shame because it was a good show. And again, from our friends at Bones. And it had a lot of great elements. Kawamoto-san, who worked on Bebop, did all the character designs. Steve Bloom did the English voice. That was one that was disappointing. But the manga just, I literally probably ended up taking returns on 90% of my inventory for that particular title. It just didn't happen, you know. But those things happen. What can you do? You know, we made our best efforts on it, and we certainly promoted it like we would of any other title, but it just didn't take off.
Wow. Okay. Ultimate Mega X asks, do you remember what happened with the K-On! Audio on the Blu-rays? Boy, I bet you thought you'd never have to take these questions again. he says the audio on those Blu-rays are in DD format. I don't know what that means.
Dolby Digital.
Dolby Digital. And I guess that's not good enough, so he's wondering what happened there.
There was a vendor who remain nameless who did something incorrect on the replication process at the very end. So it was even after the check disc, as I recall, because we would get discs that would basically say, okay, here's the final product, and we would check those. And then somehow after that, something happened that I don't recall. And I'm not Mr. Audiophile like you guys, but it was just human error. Simple as that. And, you know, they came and threw themselves on the sword. And I think we ended up correcting it at some point.
Divine Nega asks, can you tell us what happened with the Hayate the Combat Butler dub that was supposed to be made?
I don't know. Was it supposed to be made? I mean, Hayate, we acquired season one, which I think was like 50 episodes. I'm not sure we ever really intended to dub that, to be honest with you. I don't think we ever, I have no recollection of ever saying, hey guys, I think that was always planned to be a sub only because we just felt at the time that it didn't justify the expense of dubbing. I mean, that was when the market was really, really, really retracting. And so we would make certain decisions about certain titles, like, okay, is this worth the high cost of dubbing or not? You know, we didn't have an in-house recording studio as Funimation does. You know, we didn't spend money to build up an in-house studio. So all of our stuff was recorded by third parties like Magnitude 8 or Bang Zoom. You know, and that's an expensive transaction. So we unfortunately started to have to make those decisions. And Hayate was one that I think was always meant to be sub only. If a dub was mentioned, I don't remember. And probably if it didn't happen, it was because it underperformed.
Big on Anime asks, why didn't you license Banner of the Stars 3?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember. Probably because Banner of the Stars 2 didn't sell that well.
Yeah, I mean, that's an obvious answer. But Zump1 asks, is it true that there was a third season planned for the Big O?
I don't know. I know Cartoon Network was the one who basically wanted a second season because they felt that the first season didn't have an ending, and they really supported that show. So I think with their involvement, a second season came to be. But I don't think there was... not that I know of. There was never talk of that I heard.
Big on Anime asks, do you think Bandai's decision to keep singles going on for so long after others abandoned the format was a bad one?
You know, again, certain titles had certain demands. I think the picture I want to paint of Bondi again, that maybe, and look, I'm not trying to point, you know, say, well, it wasn't our fault, but there were certain decisions we could make and there were certain decisions we couldn't make because of some of the relationships I've explained. So, we weren't always able to just say, okay, we're going to just release this as a box set because the licensor in question didn't want that. They wanted to attempt the single release format and then do a collection. We had to definitely, you know, fight those fights sometimes to be able to do box sets. And again, that was just the particular situation of being us versus some other people who obviously were able to do that because of their particular relationships with their licensors. So I think we jumped on that bandwagon as quickly as we could. I'll put it that way.
I think this was likely before your time, but we are getting questions about Clockwork Fighters and Dando and why those were released.
Well, Dando was before my time, but Hiyo Senki Clockwork Fighters was as my time. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it was just considered a viable show. And as I say, it was kind of cursed in its release pattern. It was heavily delayed and there were all kinds of problems with production. And it's just one of those unfortunate shows that didn't really get a chance. So, but as to why it was acquired to begin with, I don't know. I didn't really...
Someone saw something in it.
Yeah, I don't remember. So I'm sure I heard, but I just don't remember.
Okay. He's also asking about, which titles did well, which titles did poorly. And we've kind of hit that. But, Justin, I don't know if you've got, like, the list of Bandai titles.
I had it up. Hold on, let me pull it back up.
And if there's any in there that you could comment on the relative success or lack thereof.
Should I just go through the list? It's a huge list.
It's a big list. It's over 120 titles. I don't want to force Robert to sit here and just list titles.
I'll try to limit it to stuff that came out like later, because a lot of this is Jerry Chu era.
Notable, yeah. But yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Oh, here's one that I kind of already know the answer. The DVD, eventual DVD re-release of Clamp Campus Detectives or Clamp School.
I'm sorry. So you're asking if that did well or badly?
Yeah, that's kind of what people want to know. Like, what was a success and what wasn't?
Clamp School Detectives. It didn't do that well. It did okay. You know, I don't think it was great by any stretch. That's my recollection of it. I think you're talking about the Anime Legends Clamp School Detective box set. It was okay.
Okay. The Code Geass mangas.
Code Geass mangas did well. They definitely were strong. Some did better than others, because there were quite a few. But that was a good line for us.
Okay. I know this one didn't do well. Flag.
Yeah, Flag didn't do that. It did great in Texas. I'm not making a joke.
What?
Yeah. We would go to Akon and sell out a Flag.
It's a really good show.
It's a good show, and you know, I don't know if it's that kind of quasi-military thing going on in Texas, but they they love them some Flag. If we just could have sold it only in Texas, it would have been one of our best sellers.
Okay. This one's a complete wild card for me. The various Galaxy Angel series.
You know, Galaxy Angel had a passionate minority that loved that series. That's an okay title. It wasn't great, but I tell you that there were people who just loved that show. I would get screener requests for that. That was one of the top screener requests from conventions, which never made sense to me. And I don't know why it was so popular, but there were definitely people who would contact us. Can we show Galaxy Angel? I was like, sure, if you want.
Maybe someone will buy it.
Yeah. All right. I know initially Dot Hack was pretty big for you guys, but what about the later installments?
Yeah, it never really came back to where it was in, I think, 2000, whatever that was, 2002, and when Tokyo Pop was selling like 100,000 copies of the manga. You know, it just crap. never came back to that level. Not sure why. Not sure where those fans went.
Well, while we're on .hack, just briefly, like, that was the show, .hack, like, Legend of the Twilight Bracelet, that and the original Gundam, like, that original airing of Gundam 79. I remember there was a period where Cartoon Network was like, hey, we're going to put this on at midnight, hey, it's just going to be like the old days, and then they, like, unceremoniously dumped it at, like, 4 a.m., and that was, like, the Bandai block at 4 o'clock in the morning on Cartoon Network.
Yeah, catering to the night owls.
Yeah, wow. Jeez.
Yeah.
All right, here's one that I really liked, Kanagi.
Yeah, Kanagi did okay, as I recall.
It was one of your first sub-only ones, if I recall.
Yeah, it was. And we also did the manga for that title. And it was directed by the gentleman who directed Haruhi. God, his name just went out of my head. He directed Haruhi and some of Lucky Star anyway, and he was great. He was at Otakon, and he was just famous for saying things that were very controversial at conventions. That would
Yutaka Yamamoto, there
is. Yes, Yamamoto-san. Yeah, at the Otakon, I remember he kind of was bad mouthing some of the later Haruhi efforts. No fault of ours, but I remember it was a big, big stink in Japan, some of the things he said at Otakon. But he was a fun guy. He really spoke his mind.
Those are the ones that tend to be the best, coolest to hang out with.
Oh, yeah, and he was great. And he would always wear this suit, and he was really sharp looking, you know, and he was very – he said he did the whole – he invented the entire Haruhi dance, you know, in front of a mirror in his house, and he kind of would demonstrate that to the fans. He was really a fun guy, and he directed Kanagi, so we were kind of happy to have him as a guest and be able to promote Kanagi at whatever Otakon that was, 2010 or 11. No, I guess it would have been 2010 or 2009.
Here's one that I think we know the answer to, but I'm not sure, so I'll just ask. Lucky Star.
Lucky Star did well. The manga was the best-selling manga we ever had.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That manga did extremely well. That was our number one title by far. Strangely enough, you know, it was that the little comic strip panels, but the manga sold like hotcakes. The anime, I think, did well. You know, people were, to this day, are upset that we didn't put out the sixth volume box set with the crayon variant cover. They were so upset, we finally printed a bunch of the crayon variant covers and sold them for 75 cents on our online store, and sold a bunch of them to kind of quiet those people. So, you know, again, it did okay.
Let's see here. Never got around to releasing Nichi Joe, unfortunately.
No.
Yeah. I always wondered about this. The re-releases of the Silent Mobius movies, which are gorgeous and make no sense.
Yeah, they exactly. So I think they probably underperformed. We did do some nice cases. We did some steelbook cases for those. So we, you know, definitely made an effort. But yeah, that was not what I would consider an A title that did really, really well. It did okay, you know.
I completely forgot. You guys, did you guys release Tamagotchi the movie?
I don't know if that came out or not. Huh. I know we worked on it.
Yeah, I remember the dub being made.
Yeah, we made the dub. I don't recall it being released. Huh. And if it was, it wasn't handled by us. Maybe it was handled by Bandai America or someone.
Yeah,
it
must have been something.
Yeah.
Like that. Okay. The live action Mamoru Oshii movies.
No, those didn't.
So. Yeah, I didn't think so. All right. Sword of the Stranger.
It did okay, and we did the Fathom event. You know, Fathom was a company that did one night or two night theatrical exhibitions at, you know, hundreds of theaters. And we did that for Stranger. And because of that, it definitely got more of a push than some of the other titles will. I mean, it's a beautiful looking movie and a cool story. So I think it performed pretty well because of the theatrical event. Gave it a lot of promotion it might have not otherwise gotten.
Okay. Almost to the end here. Tekken Blood Vengeance. I remember you guys made a big push for this, and I couldn't really figure out why.
Well, that was a group company effort. I mean, it was an Amco brand, and that was synergy on display. So we got behind that one. It did really well in Walmart. Actually, funny enough, it was like a mass title that it didn't really do well with core anime fans, but it did well with the mass market, strangely enough. Well, that's not surprising because it was CG animation and it didn't really look like anime.
Right.
So our effort on that was really to try to reach the mass, you know, the Walmarts and the Best Buys of that time. And I think it did well in that regard. So it was never seen as a core anime title. We have to try to, you know, convince folks at AX or Otakon to check this out. So that was an interesting one to work on because the agenda was very different.
Okay. Toward the Terra.
No, that didn't do very well. I think that was another sub only. And we kind of knew what to expect from that. I mean, obviously it's got a long history, but...
It's shoujo.
Yeah, it didn't really hit big, quote unquote.
Right.
The fans who liked it got it, and that was that.
Okay, this is a weird one. I think you guys just distributed this for Crunchyroll, but the re-release of 5 cm/s.
You know, we did release that for Crunchyroll, and I think it did. I think it did pretty well, and we were. You know, the director did a lot of promotional stuff for us, and obviously he's got a huge fan base. I mean, he's a very popular anime director, and it's a great title. So I think it did okay. You know, it did pretty well. I mean, I think Crunchyroll was happy, and that was certainly an interesting thing to be releasing a title with Crunchyroll.
I'll bet. All right. I think that's all we got here, Zach.
Okay. All right. Winding down here, down to our last couple. Got a question from Miku Hatsune asks, back in 2008, Bandai heavily marketed, quote, Project Nebula on their website, only to have it disappear. What was Project Nebula supposed to be about, and why did it quietly go away?
Oh, well, Project Nebula, as I recall, was something in the source code of the website. That only Richard Kekahuna could explain. So you'll have to try to pin down Richard for an interview someday. I'm aware of the existence of Project Nebula, but I cannot speak about Project Nebula. Only Richard can speak about Project Nebula.
Okay, all right then. Okay, and our last couple here from Meg. She asks, what are your thoughts on the problems Bandai had with their DVD mastering from the mid-2000s? Messed up audio. I'm sure this was a super fun for you to deal with. And can you go into detail on why those problems existed?
Yeah, you know, that was extremely frustrating for everyone. And it was certainly bad PR. And it's certainly a headache for me and, a headache for the company. I mean, it was a series of – it wasn't just one thing. It was a combination of elements like a perfect storm that just kept happening. And we just couldn't believe the streak of bad luck we had. But some of it was master issues. Some of it was, and what I mean by that is to go into a little more detail, you know, you would set a production date and a release date. And so you'd get a master and there'd be some problems and we'd have to wait for another master, which would take months and months and months. And some of the release dates unfortunately, for whatever reason, didn't get shifted. So in order to kind of make up time, we would have to make up time on the back end of the schedule. So once the thing was ready for replication, we would just not have the time that certain replicators required to turn the product around. So, you know, we would end up working with replicators that would accommodate sometimes a shorter window, but because of that, they were hired to, you know, they just weren't as good, frankly, and there would be a higher degree of error. That happened. There was a couple of replicators that remain nameless. They're probably out of business anyway, since most of the DVD replicators, you know, took a hit in 2009. But you know, we just kept getting the same kind of errors over and over. So we obviously cut them out of the process and went with Technicolor and Sony, and we would just kind of adjust things accordingly. So we solved most of those problems, but it was unfortunate that we had a rash of them kind of one after another. And I can understand why people are upset. You buy a product. I mean, if I buy a DVD, you know, you want it to play. You don't want problems. So we were very frustrated and sympathetic. That was one case when the, the crying masses were fully in their rights to, you know, let us have it about that. And we did our best to adjust. And I think once we started working mostly with Technicolor and some of the others that we switched to, those problems went away. But there was definitely a bad streak there that was not fun, because I was the one who had to kind of answer those questions, like I just did.
Right, yeah. Probably the last time you'll ever have to...
God, for me, you know, there are times in this conversation where I almost felt like, oh my God, you know, I'm back.
You're back at the table in front
just
of...
Just when they think you're out, they pull you back in.
Yeah, I know, you guys have pulled me back in.
So lastly, this is just sort of a fun one from our author of The X Button and comics connoisseur, Todd Ciolek. Just wanted to mention, he asked about your work in comics, which we talked about, but he specifically wanted me to mention Black Flag and Q-Unit, and I guess he wants to know about those.
Oh, yeah. Well, Q-Unit, I had mentioned earlier, I think. That was that first comic that I ever did. I co-created it with Carl Altstetter, who was an anime guy as well, who David and I had worked with running a fan club, actually, before Books Nippon and during Books Nippon. And we sold that to a company called Harris Comics. And this was during the boom days of comics. It sold like 200,000 copies. I mean, if I sold that number today, I would be the number one comic, actually. Right. But back then, we were, you know, it sold well, but it was still far shy of the million comics that certain issues of the Image books were selling each month. You know, like Spawn was selling over a million copies a month and things like that. But yeah, that was the comic that launched my career. And then from that, you know, we went on and, as I mentioned, got picked up by Extreme Studios and went from there. And Black Flag was a book I wrote, one of the many, many comics I wrote for Extreme Studios. You know, I was basically one of two staff writers with about 50 artists. So, you know, I got a lot of work, and that was just one of the many assignments I got was Black Flag with Dan Fraga, who's the creator of that. And he's still around, still. Dan's still very active on the scene and was become an animation director, actually. So, yeah, it was fun times.
Cool. All right. Well, that actually wraps it up. Wow. I can't thank you enough. That was incredible. It's rare that we get a show like this. And I'm sure Justin echoes my sentiment that we are incredibly appreciative that you came on and went through that whole thing with us. Thank you.
I can't believe you stuck with us for, which I totally called 2.5 hours.
Yeah, 2.5 hours, yeah.
Yeah, you gave me the great guesstimate. So, no, it was fun. And I always wanted to do it. You know, in the old days, I was a little hesitant because, you know, like I say, I was the guy who had the target on my chest most of the time, and you can only get shot so many times.
Right.
And I figured it'd be better to wait till the end and answer all the tough questions at once than trying to do them as I was going. But I've always admired the show, and you guys have always done great stuff. I mean, your interview with the late Carl Masick I thought was really poignant, and your interview with Chad is legendary. So I could not... join the pantheon of people who have been on the show, and I appreciate the opportunity. And you know, I think it's good that I at least got to say a few things, at least the way I think about Bandai Entertainment. And for those of you who miss Bandai Entertainment, I want to thank you for all those years of support, because of course I mentioned the people who would kind of give me a hard time, but there were plenty of fans who were really, really supportive of us and who cried a few tears when we left. But you know, anime will live. I think the American market will continue. It's just going to be very, 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 very different. And I'm happy to go off and be a relic of a former age.
Okay.
That might be the saddest thing anyone's ever said on this show.
No, change is good. And look, there's a lot of great people. Loy, who's now at Bondi Visual USA. EJ Rivera at Aniplex. Your former colleague, Gia, is a brand manager at Funimation. So, no, the industry is alive and well. It's just in different hands, different people, different strategies, and different times. And all things go through cycles. I'm happy to be part of what I was a part of, but I'm also happy to watch it from the sidelines now. So I want to end on a positive note, because I really don't see it as doom and gloom. It's just the changing of the guard and the changing of the times.
Okay, that is our show. Huge thanks to Bob for stopping on by. Theme song's Bucharest by the band New Division. You can check them out at newdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next time.